farther than I need.
Good afternoon. I'll call to order the Conference Committee on Senate File 1997, the State Government Budget Omnibus Bill for Wednesday, May 2007. It's my understanding in talking to Senate Counsel and perhaps staff, when we adopted some language last night, there was some language. We adopted the numbers on absentee voting, but I don't think we adopted any language to go along with that. Is that correct? We may have to visit that. Mr. Botter?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There are a number of sections in Article 4, the side-by-side for Article 4, that are, well, on the Senate side, they're taken from Senate File 2190, the one-time spending bill. I will take you to page R13 of the Article 4 side-by-side. There are some minor differences here between the House language and the Senate language. You may want to ask Mr. Watson to explain some of those to you.
Or what page?
We're in Article 4, the side-by-side for Article 4, page R13.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, on page 20, if you look on the House side, line 116.3, you'll see that the effective date is April 1, 2008, and you'll see that all the way through on these absentee ballot sections. And I don't, this was not something in the Senate. Maybe the House or the Secretary of State could explain the reason for the delayed effective date.
Chairman, I guess I'd have to ask someone from the Secretary of State's office or Mr. Hilty if you heard. Okay. Sorry, our election.
Actually, I think they may be best to defer to the Secretary of State's office if they're here. I know these effective dates were specifically added during the committee process. So.
Okay.
I don't either.
Mr. Black, and you'll have to identify yourself for the record again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Bert Black, legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. And actually, this is an area that Ms. Fraser is, I'm told that Ms. Fraser is at the Capitol, and she is the person who could definitively speak to that. I will take a risk and suggest that its delayed effective date is so we can have time to implement.
Okay.
And there are no state elections in 2007.
Okay.
Matt Gearing from Health Research.
Mr. Gearing.
Yes. I believe Mr. Black is correct that when this was being put together, there was consideration of how long it would take to promulgate the rules and the procedures, and since there are no elections between now and 2008, that they delayed the effective date so that the Secretary of State's office could establish procedures to make it work.
Okay, thank you. That addresses effective date. Mr. Watson, other things, issues that we should be looking at, or are there differences?
Mr. Chairman, moving on to page R15, the top of the page, it would be lines 117.35 and 118.1 on the House side, and 42.31 and 42.32. It's just a little bit different in the sentence structure, saying who would have difficulty getting to the polls because of health reasons, or who is disabled, or who is a patient in the health care facility, etc. I'd suggest the Senate language.
I'll move the Senate language on that.
Representative Kahn moves. Well, should we go back and pick up the effective dates?
Sure.
I'll
move then both the effective date, the House language on the effective date, and the Senate language on this section.
Okay. Representative Kahn moves that the effective dates that appear.
Okay, there's a list. Mr. Garen has a list of them.
Okay, Mr. Garen?
I'll do it separately then.
Oh, why don't we.
Let's do this one.
Yeah, let's do. Maybe we should do the first one that we identified. Is that what you wish to do? On page R13, that's the first one we noted. On R13, line house language, line 116.3, Representative Kahn moves the effective date of April 1, 2008. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Kahn.
And Mr. Gehring says that there are a set of other effective dates. Okay. Maybe we can.
On the effective dates, Mr. Gehring, why don't you indicate what we're looking at here?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, just as we're going through these different sections, they each have an effective date on the House side, so I don't know if you want to take them as we get to them.
Why don't we work our way through it, and as we get to an effective date, we'll flag it and deal with it there. So I think the next one was on R14, line 117.18, House language.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator West.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are effective dates only with regard to those sections in Article 4 that deal with the bill that's in 2190. Is that correct?
Senator Rest, yes. We're only looking at the language that ties into the funding we adopted last night. That's the only thing we're looking at right now.
Okay, none of the other policy.
None of the other policy issues right now. This is the only thing we're looking at right now. For that issue. And if I stray beyond that issue, please let me know. So,
as you were talking about these effective dates, the next one is actually 116.30 at the very top of the page, it's the same as 117.18. You might want to take those two together, because the next effective date on 118.12 is a year earlier.
Gotcha.
The two together might
sure. go. Okay, so Representative Kahn moves House language 116.30 and 117.18. House language. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. And then Representative Kahn moves the Senate language that appears on 42.29 through 43.2. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. And then Representative Kahn moves on House language 118.12, effective date. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Okay. Does that take care of? Do we need? What else do we have on just for that one issue? Anything further,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
The next pair of sections there, section 19 on the House side and 14 on the Senate side, appear differently in this side-by-side, but in fact there is yet a third bill that deals with that same section, Senate File 1298, which is not reflected in this side-by-side, does make the same change as the House bill on lines 118.14 to 118.24. That is, that language is stricken and the reference changed from a voter registration card to a voter registration application. It's just done in a different bill. So I don't know if you want to consider that to be identical or...
Mr. Watson, did the Senate pass that bill as a separate bill, or is it...
It's in 1298.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that bill has been passed by the Senate, and it's now in the House Finance State Government Division.
Okay. So the language that we have, the Senate language, is as it appeared in the State Government Budget Bill, but not, we've passed a separate bill that is more in line with what the House language is.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I'll move the House language in that section.
Representative Kahn moves the House language in section 19, which starts at 118.13 and then runs, I guess, through the effective date on the next page of 119.5. House language. Mr. Watson.
Just discussion. The renumbering on the bottom of 118.31 and 32 and then on 119.1 from Roman to Romanette, that could be from Roman to Arabic, since the two Arabic numbers on line 118.21 and 118.19 are gone.
Okay.
We
can say we're incorporating that, but I would also just list that as the technical things that we're directing staff to take care of, that they could fall into that.
So noted. Discussion on that motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Further things on this one section?
Mr. Chairman, the next thing is the section 20. Let me see now. 20 on the House side. No, that was not in 2190. That, I guess that's the end of... No, there's 21. 21 was in 2190.
Yes.
And that's the same except for the difference on the who and who is on lines 115, 19, and 44.3 to 4, and the effective date of August 1 rather than July 1.
Okay. Could you review that for me again? Okay, this is section 20, right?
21.
Section 21. Okay.
Section 21, the effective date on the House side is August 1, and the effective date on the Senate side would be July 1.
Hmm. Is there a preference?
Actually...
Representative Kahn.
House section uses less words and is grammatically correct.
Okay. So you move the House section.
I move the House section.
Representative Kahn moves House section 21 from 11913 through 11929. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Anything further for this one item? Does that cover it? So then, where did this start? Was that on page
R13, I think.
R13, and what started at the
section 15 on the House side.
Right, and so it would be okay. So we would adopt. We'd adopt starting the Senate language on 40.21, section 10 there. We'd adopt the Senate language except for the amendments that we've adopted where it would be House language. And that would go from 40.21 through 44.16. So Representative Kahn moves we adopt the Senate language except as it was amended by the House language. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, thank you. The next item I'd like to take a look at, I think we need to resolve the domestic partners issue. We had an amendment that was distributed last night, and I've been trying to think about the direction to go in, and I talked to a few people who have an interest in this, and I think we've got two different ways we approach this. In the Senate, we had it relating to same-sex partners, but no cost to the government because they had to provide for the cost themselves, whereas in the House language, it was expanded to provide for many more individuals. I have not had really an opportunity to read through and understand the amendment, so could somebody explain what the amendment is, and then we could maybe have a better discussion as to what the proposal is before us.
I'll let Mr. Shepard do that.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chairman, has it been distributed?
This was distributed last night. It's the A-107 amendment. I believe it was distributed to everybody last night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the changes that this amendment makes, this addresses two parts of the bill. One is the part of the bill that deals with state employee health insurance, and the other is the part of the bill that amends Chapter 181 dealing with uses of sick leave. In both places, this amendment would replace the term domestic partner with the term significant individual. In both places, the amendment would also clarify that a person can be a significant individual in these sections only if the person, where neither person is married. So a married person could not have somebody other than their spouse as a significant individual for these purposes. On if you look at the amendment, the A107 amendment on lines 7 and 8 of the amendment, it is adding some additional qualifications for what a person would have to do to meet the criteria to be a significant individual, in addition to providing for basic common welfare. It adds basic living expenses and financial obligations of the household. And then on beginning on line 10 of the amendment, that paragraph B provides that persons who want to be recognized as significant individuals would have to submit to the Commissioner of Employee Relations with respect to the state insurance plan or to their employer for purposes of the sick leave provisions, a statement certifying that the people meet the criteria. And it would have to be accompanied by one of the forms of evidence listed in clauses 1 to 5 there. Madam or Mr. Chair, the same change is made pretty much in both sections of the bill, and I think I've explained the main parts of what this amendment would do.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. If we were to just try to separate out that as only applying to domestic partners as opposed to the sick leave provisions of the bill, is there a divisible place where we could do that so I can focus in just on the domestic partners portion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, the first page of the amendment all deals with the domestic partners for purposes of the State Employee Group Insurance Program, and the second page deals with the sick leave. So it divides right at the page break.
Okay. It may be the same issues. I'm just trying to focus on the one issue at a time here. Well, is there a discussion on this? And this is a bit different, and I don't know if the House ever received testimony on this particular part. We had a floor debate, or Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, this was an amendment that we actually didn't take at the time that was suggested by Representative Emmer in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually kind of like to refer to it as the Emmer provision. And the at the time, it would be better if I could do it with a straight face. At the time, I think that Representative, I'm not sure what the purity of Representative Emmer's motives were, and so I opposed it at the time, although as I've looked at it, I've come to see his wisdom. And I would think that the, and particularly as I've read communications to the governor as to what he seems to object to, it would seem that he would have no objection to this section, plus the fact that it expands it to very many more people. In fact, I'm thinking back to my own family, where for years I had an unmarried uncle who lived and shared an apartment with his mother. My husband had two people who had been married, were now widowed and widower, very elderly aunt and uncle that were taken care of. All would fall under that. Now, the suggestion I would like to make is that we take this expansive language of the House, which does much more than the advocates have actually ask for, and then we take the Senate's way of funding it, which isn't quite as equitable as we would like for, as I would like, for domestic partners in the looking at state at the state benefits part, but it has the advantage of using the Senate. It takes a chunk of money out of our bill, which we already have in the bill, and it has the advantage of using the Senate's method of funding.
Mr. Chairman,
Sir Russ,
I would see that, excuse me, that working with the first part of it, but it seems to me there would still be significant cost on the sick leave side from what the, if, or correct me if I'm misunderstanding this, I would ask counsel to do that, for the sick leave part.
Well, yes, Senator Russ, I think I'd like to divide the amendments,
yes, okay,
just so we can
okay
fully focus on the domestic partners part, not focusing at all
for
on
the health benefits.
Health benefits, all, because it's a different issue, and they may be trying to find some consistency here, but I'd like to deal with one issue at a time. If we, and I don't know if how it's described here is workable and so forth, but if we were to adopt the approach to have all the individuals pay for it themselves, does the language work out? Does it fit? I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, that would have to be, we didn't do that in the Senate. So
right.
I think if you just take whatever language you use to do that in the Senate,
right,
it could fit into that just as well. We just change the definition of the people who are going to be paying for it themselves.
Hmm.
You never looked at that approach,
right,
Mr. Chairman. You never looked at that language.
Sure, sure.
But I think if you just, and I don't know where it is in the...
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Botter.
You'll find on R39, Section 18 on the Senate side is the provision that governs how this would be paid for.
This is Article 2?
And that's in Article 2.
Article 2, yep. Yes. Page R39.
What's R39?
And that's why the Senate language has some differences with the House. The Senate just adds language that says the same insurance must be made available at full cost to domestic partners without state payment for any portion of the insurance.
So, Mr. Chairman, there, wouldn't we need to, if after we adopted the definitional section on Section 18 on R39, we would have to say at full cost to people or persons recognized as significant individuals of state employees? Would that be what we would have to... insert there, Mr. Botter?
Yeah, Mr. Botter, I believe we'd have to, we couldn't just take the exact language the Senate has because it refers to domestic partners. It would have to be amended accordingly.
Mr. Chairman, on the Senate language on line 26.13, you could just delete domestic partners and insert significant individuals.
But we have to establish the record. We have to say, if you just, if you just take domestic partners out, it would say at full cost to significant individuals of state employees. That, does that work?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I don't know whether you need additional language as a phrase to say something like persons recognized as significant individuals of state employees. I mean, just sounds better, and it is defined, but we want them to understand what I mean.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wickler.
A simpler way could just be to add at full cost to the amendment distributed by Mr. Shepard, which would just put the Senate language into the House amendment that we have in front of us. The only difference is that it has the phrase at full cost.
Where are you?
If you compare 26.13 and R39,
right.
The only words that are different are at full cost,
right,
versus the House language on 57.3.
But that language says domestic partner.
You still have to take out.
Well, but that's, I'm saying we could amend the amendment to accomplish the same thing.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Professor Solberg.
This amendment does not deal with it, though.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
It does. Sorry. It would just be adding three words to that amendment.
Right.
Oh.
You're right.
I don't get it either.
What? Madam Chairman, I wonder if Representative Winkler could read if the language were amended in the way in which he thinks is the most efficient, what would Section 75 say?
the underlying language, just reading that, it would say, if a collective bargaining agreement or plan provides state paid health insurance for spouses of employees, the insurance must be made available at full cost to significant individuals of state employees in the same terms and conditions.
Yeah. Well, to me, the problem is still the same. It's significant. It's persons recognized as significant individuals because they have to be. It just sounds to me better. I'm sorry.
It's actually, Mr. Chairman,
yep.
would have been better to have said persons recognized as domestic partners.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because there's a qualification issue here.
Well, although, I mean, as I'm looking at this, if we were to adopt this amendment, this part of the amendment, not the whole amendment, it would be applying to R37 and R39 to only Section 74 and 75 of the bill. So these would be, well, they're not back-to-back sections of the statute. One's 43A.02 and one's 43A.24. So perhaps in a rest of our correct, you might have to amplify that to
just for clarity.
I hear you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure that I have this right, now, under the current plan that I have with the state family plan, I pay for my wife. Now, if I were unmarried, she was my significant other, how would that change what I pay? Would it change it at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. What would
be full cost for her?
Full cost.
Okay, she would pay
the employer and the employee share. Right now, of course, the employer pays the employer share, the employee pays the employee share. What the Senate language proposed was that because it was only limited to domestic partners, the individuals could purchase it, but they had to pay the employer and the employee share. As I understand the amendment that's proposed is that it would expand it to persons who are not currently eligible to be covered, and they could purchase it, and it's not domestic partners, it's other people, roommates. I'll give an example. As a roommates, significant individuals who are not eligible to be covered right now, as I understand it, and then they could purchase it, but they'd have to pay the employer and the employee share to do so.
So you don't want to stop your current arrangement. It's much more profitable.
Yeah.
It would be much more expensive if you were to change.
So, Mr. Chairman, essentially you'd be covered by the significant other would be covered by the state insurance policy, but they would have to pay the full cost of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and just following up then, certainly I would not question Representative Emmer's motives with this amendment. I'm sure that they were very pure.
We don't question motives.
Maybe so. Judgment.
Well,
that's fair.
Continuing along those lines just a little bit, I certainly wasn't even going to bring up the governor today, but since Representative Kahn already has, suggesting that he would certainly be in favor of this.
No, I didn't say that.
Well, the implications seem to be there anyway. Let me just say that in my conversations with the governor's office, this amendment still doesn't quite reach the standards that the governor would approve of. In other words, this would be grounds for his veto still at this stage. So take that for what it is.
Sure.
To get that out to you.
I'd just like to point out that the governor did send us a letter that did have a very specific line about this phrase. We can pull it out and read it. And I know, Mr. Chairman, from what I've heard, the Senate decided to meet some complaints by making the full cost with your full cost amendment, but the governor's letter, which you look like you have faster at funding than I am, we all have it somewhere.
Okay. The governor said the bills mandate domestic partner health and sick leave benefits to same-sex couples. I don't know the Senate bill had sick leave benefits for domestic partners, but as you are aware, this is a controversial issue that I oppose. As the bill, as I think I have mentioned before, as the bill was being heard in the Budget Division of the Finance Committee in the Senate, the first indication we had from the administration was that they didn't like the cost. A few years ago, I think this was to be applied to like 85 people, and now it was going to be nearly 400, and the fiscal note was quite a bit. So that's why I offered a floor amendment in the Senate to take away the cost, naively thinking maybe that'll take care of the issue, and of course, apparently did not. So that apparently it's not the cost issue. Anyway, I don't know where we go from here on that, but I do have a particular question, and I'm trying to read what's in here and see, because I think that you've got a lot of conditions and so forth that could raise some issues if this is to become law. As an example, and I haven't quite engrossed the language here yet, but it says on page 1, lines 5 and 6, where neither person is married, and where the people... Well, you may have somebody living you who happens to be married, just married to somebody else, or a child who happens to be married. Would that exclude them? I think we're talking about a person who's married to the employee, not just whether the person who's living with you is married, or maybe people are living in sin. I don't know. I don't know how far we're going to go with this, but that could be.
Mr. Chairman, and maybe Mr. Shepard can help me about this, we're intending to get rid of the issue of possible adverse selection.
Okay.
With somebody, like using Representative Krause and Representative Ertl's path, I'll use my own case. I have a spouse who gets very full, good insurance from the state, and so I don't claim anyone. As a defendant. So if this were passed, I could then just get, you know, possibly a very sick elderly relative to move in and then take this provision, which even at full cost might be an enormous benefit. So we don't want to let people like me keep the system in that way.
Well, it...
Yes, I couldn't do it because... Married.
Well, it seems to me we've got a couple of issues before us, and I guess we need to sort them out thoroughly but quickly. We could just do nothing and drop. We have differences between the two bills. We could do nothing, and if the governor has concerns with this whole area, then we could consider that. We might the Senate's we could adopt what's in the House position. This is a step toward providing a lot of people with insurance, whether same-sex couples or not, who currently don't have some. But I'm not sure if all the language and tests work, but we'll be happy to discuss it. The Senate's language is frankly in response to a rather straightforward collective bargaining issue. I believe that the language we had in here was that which had been adopted through the process. It was rejected by the legislature, this particular provision, and of course we went beyond it by requiring no cost, but we at least tried to stay true to what the spirit of the negotiations were. We could have some combinations, I don't know where the member's fence is right now. Well, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I think this language covers everything that was part of the negotiation, except the point where you had already deviated, which was
the cost.
The original language we had in the bill covered everything that was in the negotiations, except in committee, as a result of Representative Emmer's proposal, which was partially accepted in committee, the of the same sex had been stripped. So the House bill never had, once it got into this bill, referred to couples of the same sex. Mm-hmm. So that was completely out. And then the suggestion was we then decided to look further at what Representative Emma had proposed, and take the entire thing, which was the significant individual language. And then, of course, the problem that we get to is that you don't, for that one, you really don't know what the cost is. I mean, I think we were arguing that the fiscal impact was not going to be much more than what it had been before, because most people, most heterosexual people who are in that position and need the insurance benefits get married because they need the insurance benefits. So I think this is not in really violation. This really just goes beyond what the collective bargaining had arrived at, and this was supposedly to meet the issues of giving special privileges to, which I didn't perceive it as special privileges, but it was perceived by some people as special privileges to a group that they didn't want to give special privileges to.
Senator Rush.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I'm looking at that section 74, it seems to me we really do need to clarify that one of these folks is a state employee, and it seems to me that reading the amendment to clarify that that's the case, that it would read starting at 5617, significant individual means a person who has entered into a committed, independent, interdependent relationship with another adult who is a state employee, where neither person is married, and where the people, etc., so that to identify the adult, at least one of the persons, is a state employee. So we're not referring to anyone other than state employees, but we have to name that one of them is a state employee. And I would say that that's the case. That would have been the case too, even with the domestic partner definition, that we have to specify that one of these people is a state employee. And I would suggest that to be added to the amendment after the word adult on 5618, who is a state employee, mm-hmm. and then continue with the amendment on line 15 that adds the additional language after the comma, where neither person is married and where the people, etc.
We don't.
Does
that
make sense? Well, and
or is it not needed?
No, I didn't think so. Shepherd is, Mr. Chairman, Shepherd is nodding and Winkler shaking his head. So.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me the operative language is at the bottom of page R39. It's section 75 from the House, section 78-18, mm-hmm. which is current law that says employees who, you know, et cetera, shall be eligible for state-paid life insurance, hospital, medical, et cetera. So the rule is that employees are eligible. Now, the sections prior to that, which we're discussing, is a definitional section trying to define that, but you still have to go back to the fact that it has to be an employee, and then we're adding language that says that if it provides for health insurance of you know, other individuals, including, so I think it's covered by that section, I would think. The definition shouldn't have to cover it because that's the operative section, I think. Let me, you know, I'm trying to figure out what I'd like to go on this one. To be honest with you, I'd like to provide, you know, more extensive health insurance to individuals, but if the governor has concerns, as Representative Erdahl said to us, and as we've got a letter from them, I'd like to have him specifically say, you know, if he chooses to veto this bill, if it's only because of this issue, and there may be other reasons, I don't know, I hope he signs it, but if he has some problems with it, I just as soon have him say, I don't like to have the state providing health insurance for domestic partners, even if they pay for it themselves. Okay? I mean, if that is what it's coming down to, then that's the issue. You know, rather than, I mean, give them a reason to say, well, because it's too costly, because you're expanding it, that was never an intent. I mean, if the issue is we don't want to provide same-sex partners with health insurance, even if they pay for it, I'd like that to be the issue. Representative Connor.
I actually prefer to expand it to the significant conditions, mm-hmm. mainly because it opens it. You know, I actually did, at the times when we were discussing at other times, and when the state employees, in fact, came to their benefit, I did hear complaints from people that they thought that it was unfair. You know, the thing that they kind of accepted as an unfairness when you dealt with married couples, but people who had lived together for, heterosexual couples who had lived together for a long time in a committed relationship, thought that it was really unfair that that was considered less, you know, less valid than a same-sex committed relationship, whatever their reasons were. I mean, the reasons we've always said is that they can get married, so why don't they? Well, there are reasons that people have for not wanting to get married, which we may not accept, which may be perfectly valid reasons for them. I had also had people say, you know, I've lived with my you know, two sisters have lived together for a long time, one of which has a state job and one of which doesn't, and yet meet all of these criteria of being a household. And they said, why can't we have that too? And particularly when you're going to the position where they're going to pay for it themselves, which I prefer not to, but I think we have to in terms of the financing of the bill. You know, I prefer broadening it where it doesn't hurt anybody.
Representative Solberg.
I'm trying to recall the debate on both sides of the political aisle when this was before us 6 years ago, I believe, or 8 years ago, when it was a part of the bargaining, collective bargaining. And I think Representative Kahn is correct. At least that was a criticism from both sides of the aisle of some of the examples that she stated. We may have a state employee who happens to be taken care of or living with his sister, and that the original language would have precluded them from having that state employee have his sister on that contract. And that was a contention, I think, from both, if I recall right, from both sides of the political aisle at the time. So I think Representative Kahn, even though it expands it, it also enters a little bit of fairness into that particular provisions as well. That was a concern when we had the debate before the House 8 years ago.
Some further discussion? Representative Riddle, did you ask?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and certainly want to, I don't want to question all the sincerity of the motives and the objectives. I think that those are, they're very sincere, and you to be commended for that. But I think that Senator Betzold, summarized it, the governor's position fairly well, that this isn't just about money. If you have two people, one a state employee and one a significant other, who are covered both by state insurance, the governor would oppose that and would veto that, the bill on the basis of it. I also can't guarantee that that is the only thing in this bill that he would veto. He certainly has concerns about the deputies, commissioners, and assistant commissioners, and some other things as well. But, definitely on this particular item we're discussing right now, again, he would veto.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
It's also been pointed out to me, I thought we had, because I was reading this separately, that we do have to take out the language in the original bills, which refers to not be. I'll yield to Mr. Shepherd on that.
Well, Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Kahn wants to modify the amendment that would include the following additional language. Page R37, delete line 56.21 and 56.22, and renumber the subsequent clauses. And then on the back page of the amendment, there would be a parallel change. Page R45, delete line 60.19 and 60.20. This would, in both places, delete the requirement that significant individuals can't be related by blood or adoption to an extent that would prohibit marriage in the state.
If we act on the amendment, we're only going to be focusing on 1.2 to 1.26. So if we get to the other one, we'll have to make sure we incorporate. Representative Conner, I think you're moving the A107 amendment, I take it.
Yes, with the corrections that Mr. Shepard. And you did as a divided.
We've divided the first half of it.
Amendment, and along with that, the Senate way of paying for it.
Well, I think what we would be, I think if I understand the proposal, it is to be adopting the A107 amendment 1.2 to 1.26. Deleting on page R37, 56.21, 56.28, deleting that language, and then adopting what Representative Winkler had suggested on 57.3, after the word available, insert the word at full cost. And I think if that's incorporated, then that would be the amendment proposed. Is that your proposal?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Bonner.
Just for clarity, on page one of the amendment, if you're going to do it that way, I think you, if you're going to take the Senate language for the method of payment,
mm-hmm.
or rather the House language, well, that'll work. I'm looking at lines 25 and 26 of the amendment, but since you are going to use the House language, you can keep it that
okay.
way.
So the question occurs on the A107 amendment with those items incorporated. This is a bit of a change from what passed either body. Does anybody want to be heard on out here want to be heard on this amendment before we address the conference committee on it? I don't see anybody coming forward. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, the question occurs on the amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
No. Chairs in doubt. Those in favor, please raise your hand. One, two, three. One, two. I see two on the Senate side and one, two, three, four on the House side. It does not prevail. It does not have a majority on either side. So what do we do then?
It doesn't have a majority on both sides.
Both sides. I'm sorry. It has a majority on the House side. It does not have a majority on the Senate side. So it has to have a majority on both.
Obviously, go on to something else. We're missing the Senate
members.
Right. And we could also see if one of the Senate members came to stay on.
We could move on. Senator Larson is not here. I don't know how he's in the Tax Conference Committee. I don't know how long that will be. He'll be there. If we can move on, we could talk about. Is there some language?
Mr. Chairman, is there another version of this that you would? You voted no. Is there a version of this that you would prefer to?
Well, if you wish, we could move the Senate language. I guess that's the only other thing that's available. Should we take a vote on the Senate language?
Sure.
Okay, Senator Rest moves the Senate language on domestic partners.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you understand that puts us into direct conflict with the government.
Pretty much.
And?
Well, you know, I guess maybe we'll end up doing that as we go on, but mm-hmm. I prefer to wait to see if there's a possibility of getting two Senate votes for the House side.
Okay. We can hold off, sure. Okay. Could you just talk about the bottom language? What was supposed to be the bonding bill that they want for this one?
Chairman, I have that language.
Okay. There was some language. I don't know if Representative Hines had a chance to look at it. There was some language that was in the bonding bill, which was vetoed, but apparently bond counsel had some concerns about it in that particular bill, and there was some desire to try to move it in this bill. Since it's something that's actually passed both bodies, you know,
Mr. Chairman, it's the A33 amendment. I'd be happy to offer it for discussion.
Good.
I spent a lot of time last night discussing it with Ms. Rankin in the finance department. I need to. I need to have two things done before I do things before I think I'm willing to think. This amendment never appeared in the House, ever, anyplace. Do I understand that?
If I could... I'm mistaken then. I'm sorry. Mm. Is Mr. Watson around? Maybe he could give us some background in here. What's
no.
The, yeah.
I guess I misunderstood. No, so it certainly didn't pass the House.
Okay.
So we're looking.
Didn't pass the Senate.
When we've had problems with discussing or modifying language that's pass one body or the other body and we haven't done it, I'm kind of reluctant to suddenly add a piece of language that passed neither body and that maybe should be in the bonding bill. And but my specific concerns, and I don't think they've been answered, is I'd like to have get two communications, one from the advocates of this language, saying how important it is that they can't break ground on three of the bonding projects from last year, and that they also could not have done, under this interpretation, they could never have constructed the Guthrie. I've heard from, I saw a letter from the bond counsel from the Dorsey firm, who said that with this language available, they would not sign off on letting bonds. So it seems that either that's a direct conflict with either one, the bonds aren't going to be let. And I did not have the this is someone from the finance department who is then able to talk to us about what the finance department thinks of it. If a long conversation last night, I didn't get a sign off from the finance department. And one of the things that particularly bothered me was contradictory language on how long leases could be. I can look at that, but maybe we should have the person from the Department of Finance. We should ask the person from the Department of Finance.
Sure.
Or Mr. Watson. I mean, I really have very unfamiliar with this because we've never heard it in any committee on the floor or anything.
Yeah, and the Senate likewise, and of course, we should not be adopting things into a conference committee report that wasn't in either bill. This is a new issue, but Mr. Watson, and if anybody else has got any information on this, I think we need to be enlightened on that. Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, to refresh the memory of some of the members, language very similar to this passed the House as a part of the bonding bill, House File 886.
Only in conference.
All of this, with some slight changes, passed the House in House File 886, the bonding bill. It was agreed to exactly as it had passed the House of Representatives to be put into the bonding bill conference committee. It was in the conference report at a time when we did our annual meeting with State Bond Council to go over the language of the bonding bill to see if there were any constitutional or other legal problems with the language, and Bond Council raised the concern that two provisions in that language, it was six sections, were unconstitutional. And that's the letter that you saw. The letter was commenting on the language from the House bonding bill that was in the conference report on the bonding bill. This caused the House, caused the bonding conferees to say, let us just take that language out of the bonding conference report, deal with it in another bill to fix those two problems. This language fixes those two problems, with just a couple of sentences changed in the language that passed the House. The language has not passed the Senate. It has not been considered by the Senate, either in committee or on the floor. But it has passed the House of Representatives.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Solberg.
I wonder if we could get a copy of the language someplace that passed the House.
Okay. Obviously, we're not going to be voting on this imminently. We'll make sure that that's available. Is that a rest?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure I understand that sequence of events. The reason why the Senate never voted on it, Mr. Watson, is because the provision came into the bill, the bonding bill, from the House side, and then in conference was removed before because it was constitutionally suspect. And so, therefore, when the bonding bill, the conference committee on the bonding bill, was voted on by the Senate, the language that had been voted on by the House when they passed their bonding bill was no longer present in the bill. So although the House had voted on it, the Senate has never voted on it. Is that correct, Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that is correct.
Okay. Yes, I understand.
Chairman.
So, Representative Kahn.
And I apologize. I was wrong. As Mr. Watson recounted, I do remember. I did remember that going through the House. So I was incorrect.
Ms. Silver.
Is there, before we consider this, we got a ways to go yet on it, but is there somebody from the bond counsel firm, I think it's a Dorsey firm in present, that would give us an indication?
Well, yeah, is there somebody else who wants to address the conference committee on this point? Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I am Peggy Lexa with the Department of Finance. There's no bond counsel here today. I am speaking on behalf of Peter Sossen, who could not be here today. He has reviewed this language. I understand. I don't know the full history of the different changes to the language, but he still has major concerns with this language and the constitutionality of some of the provisions, as well as some other concerns about the language. So at this point, the Department of Finance would like to see this. We'd like to work with the individual parties that need this language passed and resolve further issues. We're just not ready to sign off on this language.
Mr. Chairman, there was another problem that I had with it, and I don't know who's proposing this language right now.
I am.
Okay. Oh, Representative Ross, great. Then you can tell me. Can you explain to me the language in the amendment in 1.17 to 1.20? Read that language, and then look at the language in 3.30 to 3.32. Then arrest and tell me why those are not in direct contradiction of each other.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I know. I get it. Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, obviously I didn't write this language, and it's highly technical. Mr. Watson, I wonder if you can explain why there is or is not a conflict. And we just heard from the representative from the administration that Mr. Salson was not satisfied with this language. I wonder, had you talked with anybody from the Department of Finance yesterday with regard to how Mr. Salson regarded this language, and were you informed that he had difficulties with it and didn't think it worked?
I did talk with Jane Rankin from the Department of Finance,
right,
who was here in the room yesterday, and we went over the language. She had not at that time discussed it with Mr. Salson. He didn't see it. I have not talked with Mr. Salson directly. I've talked with Bill Koretsky, who's the Attorney General for the Department of Finance, who works on these issues. He had a copy of the language. He was reviewing it. I asked him to get back to me with any comments. I have not heard back from him. So I have not heard from Mr. Salson directly or through his Attorney General, Mr. Koretsky.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, I wonder if you would respond to Representative Kahn's inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I had the same concern about the language. And the reason is because it would appear at first blush that in both cases we're talking about a lease with the public agency as the lessor and a private entity, let's say a nonprofit, as the lessee. And as I looked at that language, those two were directly in conflict. But the language has been revised since that earlier time, and in this current language, there are two little words that will show you that there is a difference. One on page one and one on page three. Okay. On page one, the little word is on line 1.9, subdivision. So that the sentence says, a reference to a lease or management contract in this subdivision, that is subdivision 2, refers to a lease wherein the public office or agency is the lessor. Turn to page 3, line 30, and you'll see lessee. The complete sentence being, a public officer or agency as lessee may lease property and improvements, and so forth. So on page 1, the state or public agency is on one side of the transaction, and on page 3, they're on the opposite side of the transaction. And that's why in the one case on page 1, it's very important that the term of the lease not be for more than the useful life, or that it must be focusing on line 1.17 to 1.19, the lease or management agreement must be for a term substantially less than the useful life of the property. That's where the state is, or the public agency is the lessor. But if the public agency is the lessee on page 3, then the lease must be for a term equal to or longer than 125% of the useful life of the property. So if we are contracting it away, that must be for substantially less than the useful life of a property. But if we are taking some property unto ourselves, we must be taking it for substantially more than the useful life of the property.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
So, Mr. Watson, when the state leased the buildings, the Freeman Building and others that were built by the St. Paul Port Authority, does that play into this at all? Because we did not issue the bonds for that.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, no, that's not covered by this at all.
Then, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, when would the state issue bonds and then be the lessee? We'd be the owner.
Mr. Watson.
Chairman, Representative Solberg, I have the same problem understanding that. And I think Ms. Rahm here can explain the transactions better than I can, but I think that the typical, well, maybe she should. Just to give an example with the Guthrie, perhaps.
Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Rebecca Rahm. I'm from the law firm of Fagry & Benson, and I have been the lawyer for a number of the cultural institutions that have been the for whom cities have received some state bond funding. And with a number of those projects, the Guthrie Theater, Children's Theater, McPhail, the State Finance Department has accepted a lease by the cities of the property for at least 125% of the useful life. So Subdivision 7 codifies existing Finance Department policy allowing cities to become essentially ground lessors for at least 125% of the useful life as an equivalent to fee ownership.
Mr. Chairman, if I can explain it in my terms, and I'll see whether I'm right. In the Guthrie transaction, the state has the money. It gives it to the city of Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis doesn't have any land, but it leases the land from the Guthrie Foundation for a term that's at least 125% of the life of the property, so that we're going to have that land, we're going to have that property under public control for substantially more than the useful life of the property.
So, Mr. Watson, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, on page 3.29, the public officer or agency is the key words in that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that is correct.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg,
the Department of Finance has expressed two concerns when they testified, that there may be a constitutional problem, and then there may be just that they don't like the policy type problem. And I would like to know where those two things are involved, the constitutional. And that's why it would really be good to have somebody from the state's bond council here. I think the Dorsey firm is for the bond council firm to at least answer the first part, the constitutionality of it. And then the second part is something that we will decide, whether they like it or not.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I would also like to know why now? Why 3 years after the fact, looking at that language, all of a sudden it's constitutionally suspect? Where was the Department of Finance 3 years ago? Or 4 years ago, or whenever it was we overrode Governor Ventura's veto on this project and it got going. What has something changed since then that transaction and that relationship is suspect? And what kind of due diligence did the Department of Finance do at the time to not raise this issue? Or if they did raise this issue, what was the response of bond counsel at the time that allowed the transaction to go ahead? And then furthermore, following your comments, which I think are very well taken, Representative Solberg, if this is constitutionally suspect, what's going to happen? If this is unconstitutional, who is holding the bag, if you will, in the relationship between the City of Minneapolis, the State of Minnesota, and the Guthrie Foundation for that building and the future payments on the bonds that have been let? It is not a simple it's not a simple thing, although if it's not constitutionally suspect, then we can just say whether I agree with you that whether we think it's a good policy or not, and we clarify it, et cetera. But if it's constitutionally suspect now, it seems to me that it was constitutionally suspect in whatever year it was, 2003? How many years ago was it?
2003.
That's 4 years ago. What's changed?
Mr. Chair. And I think there's some other things that have come up. It's not just the Guthrie Theater that is already completed, but there are some bond projects that are not going forward because of this. That I think that there's a difficulty. But maybe somebody from the department can point out, at least from their perspective, because I have a great deal of respect for Mr. Salson and the department. They've handled our bond councils very well. So if we could ask them for some understanding of where is the constitutional suspect on this? I know you're not ruling on the constitutionality of it. Neither are we, but we should be able to be pointed out where there may be some constitutional suspect.
Ms. Rahm or Mr. Watson, can you address that? Or somebody
Mr.
else?
Mr. Chair, I've actually been working with the Dorsey firm since Friday to address their concerns, and I could tell you where we are.
Please.
That would be helpful.
Yeah.
There were two concerns that were expressed in the letter. The first concern, Representative Kahn has identified, they thought that the reference to the term of the operating lease was in conflict with Subdivision 7, and we have clarified to their satisfaction with the changes that Mr. Watson identified that we're talking about two different kinds of leases, and that is no longer a concern to bond counsel. And they have authorized me to say that. The second concern they had related to the renewal option, which is in lines page 1.17 through 1.22. Their concern there was that in the draft that was in the bonding bill, the last phrase, which reads, and the lessor determines that the demonstrated use continues to carry out the program, had been deleted, and it had been in the statute. It is currently in Minnesota Statute Section 16A.695. So that language has been reinserted into this provision, and bond counsel at Dorsey has told me that I can say that I have no reason to believe, after talking to her, that they would deem this to have a constitutional problem.
Right.
Okay. Any, does anybody else want to be heard on this issue? Anybody want to address the Conflicts Committee? Obviously, I don't think we're quite ready to move ahead on it, but Senator Reston?
Mr. Chairman and members, I am informed that the process of the this language in the bonding bill was a slightly different than what I had understood that from Mr. Watson's comments, and it was that the language was adopted by the conferees and the report was signed, and at that point there was the issues were raised and the conference committee, so the Senate had agreed to it in terms of their conferees, and then the report was reopened, the language removed, and then the conference committee report came to both bodies. So it was not something that only was in the Senate, only that the House had a position on in the conference committee. The Senate conferees agreed to it too, and after they had voted to accept it and close the bill, they had this meeting with the bond council and then went back and removed it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we're a journal entry state, and I think only recorded position of the Senate was that.
I know, but I just wanted to make clear that it wasn't, but when we were talking about, well, the House had seen the language and the Senate hadn't, well, the Senate had seen the language in terms of its conferees. I just wanted to make that clear.
The five people on the conference committee had seen it.
Right.
But what happened when the House passed its bonding bill with the language that came over the Senate?
Right. They had voted on
this language onto the bill, so we never, as the Senate, never looked at it.
As the Senate, we had never voted on it, but it doesn't mean that it was not available publicly to members of the Senate.
Are there any other questions, or anybody else? Obviously, we're going to have to. Anybody from finance still want to discuss this, Representative Solberg? Or?
Just as she's coming down, Mr. Chair, we do have a copy of the bill as it passed the House. Well, I guess at least as it was reported to the House from the Ways and Means Committee, and went for the second time. So I assume it passed the House that way as well. And at least there was some language on 16A.695 subdivision 2 in that particular version.
There's a handwritten note that says amend into SF 1997 Article 2. I mean, that's our
amended
bill.
Into it, yeah. But
I see.
Because there was a.
Yeah, okay. Did you want to say anything further, Ms. Wetzel?
Again, Peggy Lexa from the Department of Finance. I just wanted to conclude by saying I think a lot of the issues that finance had concerns with were dealt with to some extent, but there do remain concerns with this language as it was presented today to Mr. Sausen. We're trying to get a hold of him right now, but so I can't speak to a lot of the specifics of the problems in this language, but I just wanted to communicate that.
Well, yeah, the bill was supposed to have been closed about 4 hours ago, so we're kind of on overtime right now as far as issues and wrapping the bill up, but I hope we can find out quickly if we're going to do on this at all. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the question that was properly asked by Representative Solberg are the issues constitutional issue or a policy issue? Because if it's a policy issue for Mr. Sausen, then we're the ones who establish the state policy, and that's...
Right. But
if he feels that there's a constitutional issue, you know, I think we certainly want to hear that out.
Sure. Mr. Chair, my understanding, and this is just based on the conversation a couple hours ago, was that the lines 118 to 122 were still of some concern to him, and I think perhaps they haven't concluded with our bond council. They're not 100% comfortable yet with this language. So that's all the information I have right now.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I withdraw the amendment.
Well, trains ready to leave the station soon, so okay, thank you. Okay. I've got a couple of things I'd like to take care of. The last night we did vote on most of the budget bill. I think there's one or two issues that we put on the list of five items that we wanted to hold off, and I'd like to, I don't think we had time to discuss them. One was the personal sick leave benefits, and the concern that we had there, I think, was the fact that although that the spreadsheets were showing a particular number, I think the language was not reflecting that, and in fact it was reflecting a much larger number, and I wonder if the fiscal analyst could discuss that. We have some concerns that if we adopted the number and then the language, it wouldn't work out. It'd be a much greater cost. Yes. I'm trying to find my own spreadsheets here. I'm looking at the Kevin Lindeen one, but this Ms. Roberts one is similar. It's on page 2 under Doer, personal sick leave benefits. I think the proposal was at $389,000. However, where's the language for this that we can look at?
Mr. Chairman, that's on R45 of Article 2, the side-by-side for Article 2.
Okay, R45. I see, okay. And it's House language 60.1 to 6014. And it's my understanding that the new language referring to spouse, sibling, parent, grandparent, step-parent, or domestic partner is much broader and has a greater fiscal impact to the tune of about $3 million than what was suggested here. If I'm not correct, could somebody fill me in on that one?
Mr. Chair, members, I can explain at least what the House is tracking. This provision originated in House File 219, as Representative Walker's bill, and we do have a completed fiscal note for the last engrossment that shows a cost to the general fund of approximately $3.8 million a year. There are also costs to other funds of approximately $7.2 million per year. What these costs represent primarily are additional costs to agencies that would have to backfill positions if employees used additional sick leave. I think that would mostly happen in Department of Corrections and Department of Human Services. So that was the approach that the Department of Employee Relations used when they calculated this cost in their fiscal note. The underlying assumption was that with the provisions in that bill, that state employees would on average take an additional 3 days of sick leave per year if this passed. If paid sick leave is an accrued benefit, so if this language passed and the legislature did not provide any funding, then those agencies would have to absorb any costs. Again, it would be primarily for overtime for those agencies that would have to backfill positions. I think to explain sort of the difference between that fiscal note on House File 219, there was a fiscal note on a similar provision, not identical, in the 2005 session that showed much lower costs. Again, they're not identical, so they're not exactly comparable, but the assumptions used by the Department of Employee Relations were that only one additional day of sick leave would be used for a somewhat similar expansion of the use of personal sick leave. So I think, and I would defer to Representative Kahn to explain the reasoning, but I think part of it was that there were these really differing assumptions and that there wasn't, the House Committee made a sort of an assumption of what they thought was reasonable.
But. Any discussion? Representative Kahn.
Chairman, I think this is the kind of thing where it's really hard to deal with what are the intangible benefits of having this. The fact that someone with a sick child who is in dubious circumstances who comes into work anyway may not be working very effectively. And the confidence that one has the ability to use sick leave to deal with these problems may be something that really helps workplace efficiency throughout all of state government. I mean, I've never had either, I nor my husband have ever had a job where we ever had sick leave. So, nor did we ever have a job where we ever had to be anywhere if some emergency was happening. But, you know, just the ability that someone can take care of something is, I think, a very positive thing in people's lives. And I think that that means, and it's the kind of thing, it's the kind of thing that we also get into about the doing things to ensure that there's not going to be a shutdown. I mean, even if we're not, if we have measures that assure that there isn't going to be a state shutdown, people are working far more effectively getting up to that day than they are worrying about what's going to happen. Is there going to be a shutdown, and are they going to have to take a vacation at a time that they didn't want to, or what's going to happen to them? So there's no way that you could ever get that kind of thing in a fiscal note. But at the time when people had many, many more duties in terms of taking care of elderly, not just taking care of themselves, maybe taking care of elderly relatives, I think this is something that recognizes the realities of employees in the workplace, and I think could have very positive benefits that you never see in the fiscal note, because the fiscal note doesn't measure someone really upset because they've got a sick kid who's maybe been left at home alone.
Chairman.
Well, there are fiscal notes and there are fiscal notes, and unfortunately, if you have a fiscal note that says, you know, $3 million, you have a spreadsheet that says $389,000, somehow you've got to reconcile the two, and if it's our decision to say the fiscal note is wrong and we think $389,000 is the correct one, I mean, we should say that, but we can't pretend the fiscal note doesn't exist. Is there a rest?
Mr. Chairman, that would be the point I would make. I would like to have the Department of Finance that gave us the fiscal note that has this, mine has total cost in 08 for this provision of 10.452 for 08 and the same amount for the outline years too, and that just seems to be, again, way, way different assumptions than what would lead us to have at 389. So I'd like to have some explanation of why such a big discrepancy. I guess I'm sympathetic to Representative Kahn's description of the current life, but when I read that the you know, they do have some difficulty in making this fiscal note, and they talk about that in terms of how many positions would require replacement. Some people can be sick and nothing changes. Some people have to, when they take sick leave, somebody has to do their work during their shift. There's no such thing as just being sick and coming back the next day. It's like a teacher in a classroom. The students have to be supervised during the period that the teacher is gone. Very different than one of us being sick. We don't have a replacement or need one. And I'd like to have a little bit more discussion on that. And they do talk about in the fiscal year 2006, the state paid $71.5 million in sick leave. And that averaged to approximately 50 hours of sick leave per employee. And then they go into the assumptions of where how they got there. And they did indicate, which is where, one of the other difficulties comes in whether how you get an accurate fiscal note, is that they don't track how employees or whether employees are using sick leave, I'm just reading from it, for a personal illness or injury or for another permitted use. And to the degree to which increasing the permitted uses, how they estimate what people's behavior would then be
you know, it's a mystery to me, too. But once again, as Senator Betz will say, this is not a difference of $300,000 and $500,000. It's a tenfold difference. And I'm not comfortable saying, well, the number is $389,000 as opposed to $4 million or $5 million or whatever. And I certainly wouldn't want our budget to be out of balance when we pass them.
Yeah, Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Roberts, in the 05 fiscal note, did it have the same terms, specifically the terms spouse, sibling, parent, grandparent, step-parent, or domestic partner?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't have the language from the bill that the 05 fiscal note was done on in front of me. I believe that it did not include domestic partners. I'm not sure. I'm almost positive that it did not include domestic partners.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, they told me last night that the previous bill had parent, grandparent, and step-parent added to taking care of child and spouse. And so that was what that additional cost was then, where it was parent, grandparent, step-parent.
Service Holberg?
I can understand when you add more that you probably have some legitimate costs, or the other thing the employee can do is just lie.
Sarah Seen.
Thank you. Well, one of the things in forming these numbers, I would think they would have some data from like family leave, past history from employees, and could kind of base their numbers a little bit more off of some solid data. It seems like, you know, they seem concerned about the data they were getting. But in any case, it certainly does seem like an awful lot of money.
Okay, is there further discussion on that? I don't know where we can go on that unless I'm going to be very cautious personally about going ahead and adopting a policy when I've got such a disparity between the numbers here. I don't know. Anybody else wants to represent Con?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ress suggested that we get the person who wrote the fiscal note to at least have the numbers. Was someone from finance to discuss?
Sure. Is there somebody here who can discuss it? Sure. We do have somebody coming down.
Yes. It was she.
Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Lorna Smith. I'm with the Department of Employee Relations. I think that the two biggest differences is, as Senator Ress was pointing out, the original bill in 2005 increased the uses for sick leave by three different things. It was parent, grandparents, and step-parent. The current bill that we're looking at increases it by seven different uses. Based on that assumption, we, in the 2005 version, thought it would add one more sick day a year. Now we're thinking it's going to be three with the additional uses. I think maybe the easiest way to think about this is that in fiscal 2006, we spent $71 million in sick leave, and that was an average of 6.25 sick days per FTE. With this language, we're estimating we'll be using 9. That's roughly half more. That was just rolling out that way, it came out to $33 million. But what we tried to do in our fiscal note is really work down to just the replacement cost of those employees. So if someone, for example, is a receptionist or they're working in a veteran's home, we have to have another employee in there. So we're now going to be paying not just that sick leave, but for another employee there to do that work. We did do a small amount of replacements in the non-24/7s as well. And we did some estimate of flat salary and overtime salary based on what we do experience. And So we thought that our, including all funds, $10 million, while it is an extremely large number, I think given the cost of sick leave is not unreasonable.
And it's my understanding that the fiscal note just reflects whether it's correct or incorrect or whatever. It reflects the cost of the state, but the language here is not... It's not specific to the state of Minnesota employees, right? I mean, this is much broader. It would employ, it might apply in the private sector as well, too. Is that correct? Does anybody know? Is this just specific to the state, Mr. Shepard? This applies to the private sector as well, too.
Mr. Chair, yes, the Chapter 181, in which this is codified, would apply to all employers, including the private sector. If I understand your question,
sure. That was my question. This is not just specific to employees of the state of Minnesota.
Okay, gotcha.
Thank you. Further, does anybody else on this issue? Representative Kahn.
Chairman, as I understand it, the existing language in contracts and plans bargained by the state generally provides sick leave benefits to care for an employee's sick or injured dependent child, as well as to care for members of the employee's household and to arrange for nursing care for members of the family. So that's pretty broad.
Although, it seems
to have everything except domestic.
Except the parent or grandparent or step parent may not necessarily reside in your household. The language of that is in the house language may use personal sick leave provided by the employer for benefits due to illness or injury to the child, spouse, sibling, parent, grandparent, step parent, or domestic partner. It doesn't say that any of those individuals have to live in your household. So the language that's being proposed would presumably apply if you've got a sick parent who does not live with you. You could take sick leave, even though the collective bargaining agreement, I believe, indicated it has to be a member of the household. So I think there's a difference between the bargaining agreement and the language. Further discussion on this one. I don't see a quick resolution here, but I wanted to flesh this one out a bit more. Anything further? No, okay. Senator Tien?
If we don't act on this at all, does that mean we have another $389,000 for other spending?
For me, it's been.
For you? Seniority, yeah?
Well, we'll find out how it all shakes out, Senator Olsen. One of the other issues we did not deal with last night was...
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry. Representative Winkler.
I guess I have a question.
Yeah.
It seems to me that every time we are getting to an issue that's not quickly resolvable, we're kind of putting it behind us and we're spending a lot of time chewing on issues that are fairly non-controversial. And we're, you know, over 4 hours past our deadline now. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to adjourn, I think, at 5:30 or at recess at 5:30 or 6:30 maybe. Is there a roadmap from here or... I'm just trying to have a sense of how far we have to go and how we're going to get there at this point. It feels like it's going to take a long time.
Well, Representative Winkler, I want to wrap this up as quickly and expeditiously as I can. I think when it's time to vote, you know, I think we need to start having motions and having full understanding what the issues are. I'd rather not slow us down when we have a motion to have people say, well, where are we? I want more information on it. I suspect there's probably we can start taking motions now on some of this and see where we're at. If that's the desire of the conference committee, we are going to take a vote to decide what we're going to do on the sick leave benefits, on the bonding language. If there's a motion to be made on that, we've already made a motion on domestic partners. You know, I'd kind of like to see there was only five budget issues. I kind of want to see where we're at and then get that out of the way and then see if we can start taking votes, because a vote on one may very well affect a vote on another. So, the maps issue, I think, was fairly straightforward. The only concern I had last night, the proposal seemed to bring the number down. As I recall, they could do a new system for $54 million. No one has really proposed that. It's trying to patch the thing up and keep it going. I think we're down to $5 million something right now, down from $7 million. Whether that's the right number or the wrong number, I don't know if anybody can tell us what a good number for MAPS is right, you know, to get through this year. Is there anybody here who can talk about MAPS? What it's going to take to...
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
And I did have a private conversation with the commissioner on this as well.
Okay.
To try to get some direction from the Commissioner Hansen on this.
Sure. Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kent Allen, Department of Administration. I work in conjunction with finance on the MAPS operations. My understanding of the finance request was that the bulk of the money was actually contingency money. They estimated that if the current system has dire problems in the next 2 years, that it could take as much as their initial request, which was $7 million, in order to make that right and keep the system operable. But the intention actually was not to spend that money unless needed. So this is an instance where there really is no magic number. They had intended to spend a relatively small amount of that money on continuing planning, and the bulk of it was to be available as needed in case there was further problem. And my boss must not like what I'm saying since she's joining me.
Well, we'll find out. Again, welcome back to the conference.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, Dana Badger, Department of Administration. My only small issue with what Mr. Allen was saying was the bulk of the money being contingency money. The estimate is that we would need $2.5 million of the seven to continue our work to get ready for a request for proposal. For the big bang replacement of the whole thing. We've been working using available finance and admin funds on a kind of a shoestring to try to make the case for the system, to develop the requirements. But this is, of course, a very significant undertaking with huge risk, and we would want to spend the time that we would be given between now and the next budget request continuing that effort with consulting help, and the $2.5 million, the largest portion of it would go toward technical and systems consulting help, helping us understand what other states are doing, the lessons learned, both good and bad, in the implementation of these major systems, seeing what software vendors have to offer, maybe doing some tests and demonstrations of those software programs. And so it's a kind of a continuation. It's more than a pilot light. It's really getting us ready for the next step, and that is $2.5 million of the seven.
So, again, seven is the ballpark area that you're looking at. Okay. And we had a tentative number on the last spreadsheet, 5.75. That was, you don't know, I take it, but, you know, seven's what you're looking for.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the real issue here, it is a roll of the dice. Every time we do a software upgrade to our mainframe environment, and this is a mainframe operating system, we run the risk that this ancient legacy system won't work. And the possibility is that we might have to run dual systems. In other words, we might have to keep the old servers running and keep the MAP system going on a kind of a crippled basis while we upgrade our new servers to the new software. That would mean that everyone in the state who operates MAPS would have two computers on their desk because they would be operating on one system for their financial procurement and accounting processes, and they would be operating on their other computer for their email and other office functions. So that duplicate desktop provision, the duplicate server provision is what that contingency money is intended for. We don't, you know, we're hoping that doesn't happen, but it could.
Representative Erdl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While Commissioner Bradgerl is before us, are there any other particular concerns that you have in the budget direction that we're taking?
Oh, my.
Commissioner?
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair,
Representative Rudolph for the open invitation. We just have a couple of minor issues remaining. I think I've mentioned one several times, which is that we think the grant management responsibilities are really significant. We think we have a large task ahead of us and an important task for state government efficiency and for our nonprofit community, and we really do worry about the method of funding provided in the House bill, which does require that we go assess against all grants statewide a very small amount to pay for that office.
Which we do not adopt, by the way.
Yeah, I understand, but it is a concern in an item that has not yet been really adopted or discussed. But what you have adopted is the limited funding, which is providing for only one person for 1 year. So we don't have a continuity there in that office. So I think if we believe it's a valid function that needs to be performed and sustained, we would very much like to have the governor's recommendation on that item. The other issue, of course, is the disparity study, and I know that that is also an issue that hasn't yet been discussed and is in contention, but the amount funded in the House version is not sufficient to our knowledge. We've done benchmarking of other states. We have not found any state that has been able to do even an update of a prior disparity study for anything like $425,000. The numbers tend to be in the $700,000 to $800,000 number. So if we're given the $425,000, we can always ask a vendor to do it for that, but we haven't seen it happen at that price level in any other state.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Kahn.
I guess one of the things that I found a little strange, looking at the Office of Grants Management, this funding method is an extensive administrative burden which would drain appropriated resources. You know, I'll go over and do it for you in an afternoon. It's well within my mathematical ability to do that. And when I was talking to Mr. Shepherd, he said he'd do it too, so the two of us can do it in a half an afternoon. I mean, this is literally, it's not even calculus. It's just third grade arithmetic that we're looking at.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, it isn't a question of calculating the amount. We, too, can do that rather easily. It's a question of assessing it and collecting it. We do run a number of enterprise funds in the Department of Administration, and we have entire accounts receivable departments that do that collecting of the fees. There are also some issues, I believe, with respect to whether or not those fees can be charged against federal grants. Operating in the MAP system is cumbersome at best, and to try to do these interagency transactions with a single person who is otherwise trying to set up a grants office, that's the undue burden that we were mentioning.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, the first suggestion would not be to collect it back but not to give it out in the first place, and that's where the arithmetic would come in. Someone has a grant, at some point they get in a check. Someone makes a calculation and they take that money off the check and they get a smaller check. And, you know, then that's conferred to, and finance is doing all of their issuing the checks, and they issue a smaller check, and they record the amount that they didn't issue in that check, and that goes into the fund that, that deals with it. Now, the federal government, I know, is used to paying, and federal grants, they're used to paying, federal grants to an institution for research, they're used to paying some rather large overhead costs. In fact, I noticed that private, at the time, this is a very long time ago, but when I had private grants and when I had federal grants to do research, the private companies like the American Cancer Society were much more successful in negotiating a better overhead function. So in a sense, it's the state negotiating an overhead function with the federal government, but they're certainly used to it, and they certainly do it for state agencies that, for other places that they give grants to. And I don't know if the state gets overhead from the federal government on federal grants, but then this would just be part of that overhead.
Mr. Chen, Representative Kahn, I understand the desire to spread the cost of this grant management office against the agencies who are going to benefit from it, but I do have a proposal, which is that if generally funded, what happens in any event is that gets built into the Department of Finance's indirect costs.
which are then spread against all state agencies. So in any event, state agencies are going to be paying their share of this, and it, in most cases it will be a very small portion of the $375,000 that we're seeking here. But so actually, by generally funding it, we are achieving essentially the same effect in having the agencies who will benefit from the office pay for it.
Further discussion? Any questions of the commissioner? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah-Lucine.
Would it be appropriate for me to make a motion to drop the personal sick leave benefits?
If that's your desire, you may make that motion.
I would like to make that motion.
To eliminate the sick leave benefits. Now, that's that was on the spreadsheet at 389. We did not adopt that last night. So I guess it would be you'd be moving the Senate position, which is we had some numbers on there, so delete the sick leave benefits. I think that would be the cleanest way of doing it. Do you wish to be heard on that motion? Or you don't have to. I mean, is there anything you want to wish to say?
My concern, Mr. Chair, is that there is such a difference. I mean, if we were talking even a few $100,000, but many millions of dollars difference, I think in lieu of our time factor and all of and the difference in money, that I think it's something we could maybe look at in the future, but not now.
I think the proper way to do it would be to move to adopt it, simply because if you move to delete it and it fails, I don't know what the status is.
Oh, okay.
If you move to adopt it and it fails, then I know what the status is.
But
it's not. Representative Solberg?
And I suggest that maybe there are four or five different issues that we have up, and they've kind of phased. I mean, they don't stand single. You might take this and move it to some other place and some of the negotiations. So.
Well, that's why I was, Representative Winkler raised a question, and that's why I wanted to kind of get a feeling for all the issues. If Senator Olsen wants to make the motion, you can do it. I would suggest if you just hold off on a minute. We're going to get to that issue. What I'd like to do is talk about the budget trend study and then have that discussion, because the other two are just big-ticket items, and I think we're going to have to just discuss that. I don't. We on the budget trend study that we were at 200,000. Where was the language on that? R78, and that was a Senate language. I think the difference, as I recall, Representative Kahn, I think you liked the concept, but you felt it ought to be done within the Department of Finance, and the language that the Senate has requires the assistance of the Department of Finance. However, it would be done, I believe, through the LCC. If you had any further thoughts on that, Representative Kahn?
Well, Representative Solberg.
Representative Solberg.
For the thoughts
on
that.
Okay.
Well, I'll let him speak for himself. He's been the person in the House who's worked most on these issues.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, I have had some conversation with Representative Cohen, or Senator Cohen, on this.
Mm-hmm.
I guess once a representative, always a representative, so he was. I guess that's proper also.
But, we say house trained.
Yeah.
House broken?
Yeah.
We didn't train him very well all the time.
That's easy to be trained under me.
That's right. But I think I want to have a few more opportunities to have some conversations with him to understand his goal on that. I think if we ask the Department of Finance to kind of provide the oversight of this, or I'm looking for the language here. It says
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silberg, paragraph C.
Paragraph C, yes.
Requires the assistance from the various
agencies. Provides the data. Obviously, I think that's, you know, somewhat of a cost. I have had some preliminary conversations with Senator Cohen on what he thinks that true cost is. I think the goal may be okay. To do that, like I stated, that there is a bill in the Ways and Means that we haven't acted on yet that can ask for the same type of data as opposed to this big, huge commission to do it. I think the Department of Revenue has within when they do the forecast, you know, they are able to collect some of that data, and they kind of our forecast reflects that a little bit, particularly in the area of health and human services, because they project what the trends are going to be, they project how many people are going to be needing a particular service. The same thing is true in education. You know, they project if there's going to be more kids or less kids in their forecast all the time. So they do that. There is a section 1 where on 40.16 to 17, there's a issue on over the next 25 years of the tax base and the revenue collection for state income tax and so forth on that. I know that's been a little bit of an issue on in the tax committee as well. So I really have some difficulty of going down this particular road right now for adopting it. I think the tax committee is looking at maybe doing a small study on the tax portions of this. So I think we just need to hold off a bit on this.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Russ.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether it's appropriate in this bill or in somewhere else, whether it's in the Tax Committee or in your Ways and Means Committee to take up this issue in another bill. But I was in a meeting with the state demographer this morning, and he was extremely interested in the scope of this particular project, and of course it does say in those lines 47 to 4014 that the state demographer would be involved, and he thought it was very provocative to be looking at and very forward-looking, to complimenting Senator Cohen, to be looking at the way in which the demographics play on the revenue and spending trends in order to have a more realistic economic policy going forward. And I'm saying that in support of the study as opposed to whether it's appropriate for it to be in this bill and funded at what level, but I thought that was a very interesting comment from someone who's outside of the political realm, but is involved, asked to be involved in this, that he thinks it's an extremely valuable path for us to undertake. Whether it's done this year or next year, whether it's done in this bill or some other bill, that's you know, we make that decision, but I think that given all of the demographics information that we hear from Mr. Stinson and Mr. Gillespie, that this is a very insightful approach to dealing with our future economic capacity.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern right now is I know I served on the tax committee, and the tax, I think there may be something in the tax bill that was passed by the House that is asking the Department of Revenue to look at the tax base and what's happened to the tax base as we make exemptions or for this tax or exemptions to sales tax or what happens to the fairness issue. Obviously, that has to be taken into a mix of things, too. So I think we just need to kind of step back and not adopt something at this particular time and let me get some more understandings of where we're going to go and probably even talk to the PAC chair on this issue as well.
Well, is there further discussion on the Budget Trend Study Commission? I'm sorry, Representative Winkler has stepped out, but we've talked about three of the five issues that were not adopted last night as funding issues, and I think we probably ought to come to some closure to figure out what we want to do on them. We have MAPS, which was a one-time expenditure of about $5.75 million, one-time. Sick leave benefits of $389,000 ongoing, and then tails into that. And then the budget trends, which was $200,000 of one-time money. So those were three things that we did not resolve last night. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, just to, you were asking about motions. I'll just make one and see where we are with that. I would, rather than make a positive motion to have defeated on the, as Senator Olsen was suggesting, I would move that we transfer the money that's there for the personal sick leave business benefits into the MAPS line, which would make that go up to $6 million $6,149,000.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes. isn't there a prior motion on the table, or did Senator Olsen withdraw his motion?
That. Yes. Okay. Now, I guess I have to have it clarified. The sick leave is ongoing money. The MAPS request was one time. Does that, are we mixing and matching the right way here? Can that
well,
be
Mr.
Done?
Chairman, but that still could be just reducing it, then reducing the tails.
Okay, so that could be done then?
Oh, we do. Tails targets.
I don't want to do anything that's going to annoy our fiscal people. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem is we have five outstanding fiscal issues, and we have a chunk of policy issues that some of us have a lot of interest in. And I guess we're certainly not willing to solve the fiscal issues one at a time. We certainly want the package, a package that decides. Maybe we want to put the MAPS, maybe if we're not going to do the, first of all, we do have to make this decision at some point. Are we going to do the sick leave and just let the agencies absorb it? Are we going to, which we've done before? I think both houses have done that at various times. The next thing is, to make things, do we want to take the, if we don't want to do the sick leave, do we want to take that money then and put it into the targeted, maybe put it into the targeted group disparity study, which is another point here that we see that we're missing about that, almost just about that amount of money to do the targeted group disparities money and get that done. Do we, then the whole basic issue also about we have yet to come to an agreement on some big issues like this large amount of money that the Senate wants to put in for the Capitol and the fact that the House is very nervous about putting that money into the Capitol. So I'm not sure it's appropriate. I know it's appropriate to discuss these things in one at a time, but I don't really think we can make motions and decide on them one at a time. I'm not ready, for example, to vote yes on that motion, although I might vote yes on it as a package of motions.
Well, let me just indicate the direction I see it. For the big ticket item, we've got the capital renovation issue out there. The House had also alternatively discussed integrated tax system money. Those are two very large items. Now, we don't have to do either one. You can't do both. I think we agree you can't do both. We could do one of the two. I think it would be not a good idea to say we're not going to do either and somehow redistribute the $10 million. Given the progress that we've made on the spreadsheet, going back and reopening it to redistribute $10 million, I think would be problematic. We've agreed on everything else. We've got three relatively small items. I think we should resolve that. We will go to the big ticket items, at least the direction that I hope to go in. We'll get have a decision one way or the other. As for the other outstanding issues, we have election issues, which we're prepared to discuss. As soon as I get these items out of the way, I do want to have some discussion on the election items. We have a number of issues in Article 2. We started that discussion last night. I anticipate at some point, you know, we'll have to revisit that, but at some point we have to resolve the budget issues because this is a budget bill. And the other issues are completely independent, in my view, of the budget issues. We can just discuss policies, but let's get the budget resolved because that is our charge here.
Well, so, Mr. Chairman, yeah. Unfortunately, the House, instead of your perspective, the House views it still as an entirety.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to have the whole thing put together as it is. It's not quite as simple. Let me give you a scenario. I'm not making this as a motion, but let me give you something that we do. Suppose we decide we're going to do the integrated tax system, which is a flat $10 million that apparently really can't be shaved to do something.
Mm-hmm.
We then decide that we're going to do some money, like if we're not going to do the tax system and we're not going to do the targeted disparity system, or we're move that money around, take some money from MAPS and do more than what we have in the budget right now for the capital system. So it's not really just the $10 million versus the $10 million plus the other ones, because those things, I know they're little items like $200,000 and $300,000 and those kinds of things, but those, you have a bunch of $100,000s. And after a while, they start adding up to $1 million. And you get a couple of millions, and soon they start adding up to numbers like $10 million or half of $10 million or something. So it's really hard to just say there are big items and little items.
Well, but the fact is, we have five items on the sheets after we've exchanged our offers and gone back and forth. There's five items that we did not decide last night. We seem to have an agreement on MAPS. It was in both of our offers. That's $5.75 million of one-time money. There's a House position for sick leave benefits of $385,000 on the spreadsheet, but the fiscal note is reflecting something else. The voting trends, budget trends, is $200,000 one-time money. I think if we were to not do any of those three things, I think we could redistribute those dollars. I don't think I have a desire, if for whatever reason, on either the capital or the integrated tax system, if for whatever reason those were to fail, to try to redistribute $10 million is going to be, that's going to take some doing. I mean, we can do it. I mean, there are things that have needs, but I think we can distribute these smaller ones. Well, yeah, we could do a lot of sick leave for $10 million. I want to go there. Yeah. Hell, we could give a month of sick leave to everybody. At least state employees. State employees.
We may need it.
Yeah. Yeah, we may need it. I would like to try to at least, you know, frankly, and I'll just tell you, I mean, we're in overtime here. And if a motion were to be made to close the bill right now, I could do it. I think I'd be prepared to vote. I don't know where my colleagues are on either side, but I don't have the desire to spend a lot of more time doing things when we've got most of our work already done, and then just trying to argue over some of the things that in the end I don't think
Mr. Chairman
have to be done. So rest.
Notwithstanding, but I paid attention to mm-hmm. Representative Kahn's comments. I think we have to start get going, and mm-hmm. I offered a motion, and if it gets defeated, other people can offer other motions and that are packages, and whether the two groups need to have a few minutes to have a package to say, fine. But I have. Currently, I have a motion. and I guess I'd like a vote on it. I mean,
and your motion was to take
this
to...
We need to start moving.
Right, to use the sick leave money and to put that where into the...
into
disparity?
The... into the maps, which would bring
the
to 6 million, whatever it is,
okay.
As I said, 6149.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Well, I think the more appropriate motion is to decide whether we're going to do the sick leave or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, making the motion to transfer the money from one item to the other and leaving one at zero, then that means that there is no provision for the sick leave. And the motion does not include any action on the sick leave. And in order to adopt the sick leave, you need a positive motion. And so I'm just trying to get us going on something. And if it's defeated, well, then we go somewhere else, you know. Take up something else.
There is a motion to use the, from Senator Rest, to use the sick leave benefits, $389,000 ongoing money, to transfer that to MAPS. Is there discussion on that motion?
Well,
Senator, Representative Kahn.
I guess I would just urge people to vote no on it. I think it's a piecemeal discussion that doesn't finish us.
Okay. Motion before us. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
The motion does not prevail. Is there another motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there were certain things that we did. For example, yesterday we did a bunch of things on money to the Secretary of State's office, and then we didn't put the language that was in R2. I think it may have even been identical language in R2 for the Secretary of State's office. And I guess I'd like to take care of that angle. We already have the money in, and I think we don't have the language in.
Well, Chairman, if that's the HABA money, then I think that's not necessarily the case. And if we can't act on these other items, I'm not particularly interested in going in and just filling up on Article 2 without some... the argument you were just making on some sort of global arrangement. So I'm not interested in that.
The HABA money was taken care of. There are some policy issues, but I think that the policy things can be discussed separately from these specific budget issues that have to be done. So because the budget part was taken care of. Is there another motion? Representative Kahn.
I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we need Mr. Black to tell us what needs to be done. But I don't understand how you can take care of the budget issues without taking care of the policy issues that are related to the budget issues.
Representative Kahn, it seems to me MAPS, sick leave benefits, and budget trend study, and plus the other two issues, capital renovation and the computer system, I mean, those are direct spreadsheet issues. Those have to be resolved. We'll get to the other points, and there's probably a way to get there. But I want to close out the spreadsheet so that we can talk about the other items.
Chairman, there's a little problem that House members have in that the grounds from comments that you've made in the committee and out of the committee, it seems to me if we close the spreadsheet item, there isn't going to be any willingness to talk about other items, judging from actions that happened yesterday and so forth.
Well,
so I think it, you know, so I don't know what.
Let me move to the next step then. Mr. Watson, are you available? Let's talk about do we have a handout that shows the election bills?
Mr. Chairman, I think that Ms. Monaghan has the handout.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, does everybody have...
I'm just bouncing off the wall.
Okay, Mr. Watson, perhaps you could start discussing. We have a handout that says Senate elections bills and House state government bill. Could you describe what this is, and can you describe the status of what's in the House bill and what Senate, what the Senate is on some of this, and any differences?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, the way this table is laid out, it shows the various sections of Article 4 and Article 5 in the House bill, the subject, and then where there might be found companion language in a Senate file. The Senate file is indicated along with a section number, who is the Senate author, and where that Senate file is in either the House or the Senate. The first group of sections 1 through 10, or actually it's 3 through 10 sections in the House bill, are 3 through 8 in the House bill, are contained in Senate File 1298, which was authored by Senator Higgins and has passed the Senate and is in the House Finance Committee. Then Article 4, Sections 1 and 2 do not appear on this list because there is no companion Senate language. Those two sections that have to do with how you qualify by petition to become a major or minor political party were deleted from the Senate version of Senate File 1298 before it passed the Senate. So there is no comparable Senate language. When you get down to Section 10 of Article 4, access to a voter's military ID number, that one is in Senate File number 1218, authored by Senator Erickson Ropes, and that has passed the Senate and has been substituted for the House file on the House General Register. So it's sitting there now on the General Register. Sections 11, 12, and 13 from the House file are in the Senate bill, Senate File 1997, as it came to Conference Committee, in Article 2, Sections 26 to 28. And they're shown on the side-by-side, however, as a part of the Article 4 side-by-side. Section 14 from the House bill is in Senate File 1298 in the House Finance Committee. Sections 15 through 19 were in Senate File 2190. They appeared in the side-by-side, and earlier this afternoon you agreed to include them in this bill in conference. So those sections from 2190 are all taken care of. On the next page, the House section number 20, electronic ballot marker, that's another one that's in Senate File 1298 in the House Finance Committee. Section 21 from Senate File 2190 was one of those ones that was adopted earlier this afternoon. Sections 22 through 24 in the House bill are in Senate File 1298 in the House Finance Committee. Then the next group, 25 through 33, are all parts of the overseas absentee ballot bill 1218, which is sitting on the House General Register. Then we're back in Section 35, the Senate File 1298. That's 35 and 36. Going down through
He's on the House General Register.
Mr. Chairman, if it says on here general orders, that would be in the Senate, but the General Register is in the House. If it were to say on the calendar, that's in the Senate. If it's the calendar for the day, that would be in the House.
Right.
these are bills that have passed the Senate, and the companion bill for some of these are on the general register of the House right now.
Yeah, all of these bills have passed the Senate and are somewhere in the House.
Yeah.
Moving to the top of page 3, section 37 from the House file, 37, 38, and 39 are all in Senate file 1298 and the House Finance Committee. Sections 40 and 41 are in Senate file 753, which is on the House General Register. 42 through 53 are all in Senate file 1298 on the in the House Finance Committee. And turning to the top of page 4, section 54 on the school nonpartisan election judges is in Senate file 753 on the House General Register. Sections 55 through 59 are all in the House Finance Committee as part of Senate file 1298. Sections 61 and 62 are parts of Senate file 124, which has been on the calendar for the day, and I don't know if you took that up today in the House or not. No?
At least not that one.
Okay. Then sections 63 and 64 are in Senate file 1298 and the House Finance Committee. Section 65 on the certification for the readiness of the automatic voter registration, that's in this bill, shown in the side-by-side with Article 4. Then the repealers are all in Senate File 1298, and all of Article 5 is in Senate File 1310, Senator Lori's bill, which is on the General Register. In most cases, the language in the Senate files is identical with what's in the House bill, but there are some differences.
Mr. Watson, are you able to identify any particular differences between the Senate bill and the House? Recognizing that some are still in the House Finance Committee, so the House has not taken a position on them, but are you able to highlight any significant differences between the Senate bills and the House bills right now?
Mr. Chairman, I think it might be most helpful to begin with those sections that are in Senate File 1997. That would be the sections relating to the automatic update of voter addresses and the automatic voter registration. Those would be sections 11, 12, and 13. They appear on page 1. And we went through those the other day and pointed out, starting on the bottom of page R9 in the Article 4 side-by-side, section 11 on the House side and 26 on the Senate side are identical, and sections 12 on the House side and 27 on the Senate side on page R10, those two are identical, except that in that case, those sections have a different effective date. The House effective date is April 1 of 2008, and the Senate effective date is March 1 of 2008.
Which line is this?
This would be on the top of page R11,
okay.
Line 113.26 on the House side and 29.31 on the Senate side. So you've got two sections identical that, other than the effective date, you could adopt. And they tie to the money for the automatic voter registration system that I believe is in the bill as part of the HAVA appropriation that you've agreed to.
Okay. Are there other, again, differences that you're aware of?
Moving forward, just to explain, remember that difference on page R11, line 114.10 on the House side and 30.16 on the Senate side, the difference between if the applicant has not declined and unless the applicant has declined.
Yeah.
Then the other difference was in the on the top of page R12, where the head note, which on the House side, subdivision 5, reads effective date. On the Senate side, it reads registrations dated 20 days or less before election.
Mm-hmm.
And then the effective date on the Senate side is shown in this section, but identical language for the effective date is shown in the House version at the end of this article. Otherwise, that group of sections that relate to the automatic voter registration that whose money you've already adopted are identical. Did you want me to go forward and find out more differences?
Yeah. If you could highlight just some of the differences, the significant differences.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Sir, I'll see.
Since the bills in the Senate all traveled on their own, and these are all in a big policy bill, what's the game plan here?
Well, I just want to highlight that there are differences. We have a lot of bills that the Senate's processed individually. The House has put, I believe, well, there's a lot of things in this bill that we've got that the Senate has had travel independently. And some of the companion for the Senate bills are somewhere within the House, and we're just trying to figure out where this election stuff, are we going to conferee it here? Are we not going to conferee it here? But I want to get some sense of what the differences are. You've got the list, and I just want to see what the differences are.
A quick follow-up then. With that possibility then, if this is not moved as part of this conference bill, these bills are still moving in the House individually, so they'll be...
We don't know.
Okay.
I cannot speak for the House.
Thank you.
They're not.
Okay, apparently they're not. So, okay? Just watch.
So, Mr. Chairman, I've covered the sections that were in both bills, that is, were in Senate File 1997. Now I'll go back to the beginning of Article 4 and talk about the sections that were only in on the House side and differences that there may be with the separate bills that traveled separately on the Senate side. Back to page R1, as I mentioned earlier, sections 1 and 2 from the House bill were not included in any bill that passed the Senate. Sections 3 and 4 were identical to the language in Senate File 1298. Section 5 on line 106.23 and 106.24, there's a slight difference in the wording of that language about the website maintained by the Secretary of State. The House language is, if the website maintained by the Secretary of State provides, and the Senate says the Secretary of State may maintain a website function that enables an individual, etc. So it's very similar. But
mm-hmm.
Section 6 is identical to a section in Senate File 1298. Section 7 is very similar, but it's not the same to a section in Senate File 1298. The difference is in two or three areas. First, in the definition of utility bill on line 107.18, the House bill defines the three-word term current utility bill, whereas on the Senate bill, it just defines the word current. And there's a separate definition for utility bill. In the House bill, on lines 107.25 and 26, you'll see there's a separate paragraph there, a clause, for a tribal ID. This is a photo identification issued by a tribal government of a tribe recognized, etc. In the Senate bill, that language is old language that appears later in this same subdivision. If you'll turn the page to page R7 and look at lines 109.34 to 110.7, you'll see the same description of a tribal ID issued by a tribal government recognized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and also language about presenting an identification card of that kind, and also presenting one of the other documents to prove your residence. What the House has done is taken this old language and moved it, recodified it, moved it up to the beginning of the section. But the substance is the same. That change of the location of the tribal ID has an impact on the language on the bottom of page R5, whereas in the Senate language, that clause 2 about presenting a photo ID is just all one clause. The House has broken it down into two parts and added clause 3, talking about presenting an identification card issued by a tribal government. Again, that's the language that you saw later in the same section, but stricken on the House side. So it's just being moved, recodified, as it were. On line 108.30, the House is changing the term picture identification card to photo identification card. And the Senate did not do that. Now, everything else that I've talked about, I think, in this elections article has been mostly matters of form. But there is a matter of substance that appears starting on line 108.36 and going down to line 109.10. That's the provision that limits a person who is vouching for another to get registered on election day to 15 people that they can vouch for. The Senate bill, Senate File 1298, strikes that language that begins with a voter who is registered to vote on line 108.36 and then continues down through line 109.10. Toward the bottom of the page, the paragraph D on tribal band members.
Excuse me, Senator.
Mr. Watson, what is the difference?
The Senate adopted some language to strike current law.
Right.
The language that's on 108.36, current law. The language that's on 108.36 it says the voter has to may vouch for up to 15 proof of residence oaths. The Senate has proposed to eliminate that, strike that out. So, I mean, the House keeps it as current law.
The House kept current law.
Yeah, the Senate proposed to change it. That's a substantive change. Yep.
Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page R7, lines 109.34 to 110.7, that's the recodification of the language on the tribal ID. The effective date of September 107, the Senate does not have that effective date, a delayed effective date. Section 8 is identical to a section in Senate File 1298, as is Section 9 and Section 10. We've also already talked about 11, 12, and 13. Section 14 is identical to a section in 1298. Section 15 is one of those that you already talked about and adopted earlier this afternoon. 15, 16, 17, I think was up through 20 you adopted. Or through 19 you adopted. 20 is identical to a section in Senate File 1298. Section 21 you already adopted. Sections 22, 3, and 4 are, except for some punctuation, identical to sections in Senate File 1298. Section 25 is the first of several sections that deal with the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, UOCAVA. And there are a number of differences between the House language shown here and the Senate language contained in Senate File 1218, which is now on the House General Register. The first of those differences is on lines 121.7 and 8, where the House language talks about a person being eligible to vote from overseas, even though they may never have lived in the United States, if they had a parent who is eligible to vote, or currently have a parent who is eligible to vote. The Senate language reads, because although they have never resided in the United States, their parent maintained residence in Minnesota for at least 20 days immediately before their parent departed from the United States. Section 26 is identical to language from Senate File 1218, except on the last couple of lines there, 122.3, whereas the House says the voter may attest, the Senate added a voter or other individual requesting absentee ballots may attest, since people other than the actual voter can request the ballot on the voter's behalf. The Senate does not have the delayed effective date shown there in line 122.5. In section 27, the difference from the Senate language, well, maybe I should also point out, in Senate file 1218, there is an additional section 4 that does not appear in the House bill, and that has to do with the requirement of the county auditor to record information on an absentee ballot application when it comes in, record that information into the statewide voter registration system. And the Senate language requires that also added to the system be the voter's military identification card number, passport number, Minnesota driver's license number, or state identification number, so that if they are registered through this absentee ballot process, that military and passport information will be included in this electronic system. See, on the section 27, there's a second section in the Senate file 1218 that does not appear here in the House side by side, and that's one that removes a reference to the municipal clerk being the agent for receipt of these overseas absentee ballots. Because when this bill was pending in the Senate, concern was raised that these absentee ballots would be coming in, and if they were not reviewed and processed before Election Day, then it wouldn't be until the last minute that the election officials noticed that there might be a variance between the military ID number used on the application and maybe a passport number that was used on the certification of voter eligibility when the ballot came back. And they wanted to have time to make that reconciliation. So the amendment in the Senate committee was to require that these ballots all go to the county auditor rather than to the municipal clerk, and that there be an absentee ballot board set up to process all of those absentee ballots in the 30 days before Election Day. The difference in section 27, let me just read the Senate language there. This is on line 122.10 and 11. For the new language, what the Senate says is, unless the voter requests to have the ballots and related materials sent electronically under section 203B.225.
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Kahn.
I actually have a
problem, because we have a problem. As you know, I told you that I needed
yes.
to leave early tonight
yes.
and had to be away until 9:30.
Okay.
I think we want House members to... House members also want some time to have a caucus and a meeting.
For sure.
To perhaps...
Would you like one now?
Prepare our roadmap for okay. finishing. One suggestion I would have is Mr. Hilty is our point person on elections, and if... I'm not sure who... I don't know if you've assigned a point person on your committee for elections, but... If those two people could meet in this 6 to 9:30 period and
mm-hmm.
come up with a decision of what they want to do on the election stuff, that might... it's kind of like setting a working group on elections to deal with that. Then we could possibly deal with everything else from 9:30 on and be finished. But I do need to call my people for a caucus now.
Understand.
And
well,
as I apologize, sure. I do have this commitment. I do have to leave
so
the building.
I understand. Well, we can stop here, sure. and but we got a flavor for what's in here. Actually, Senator Larson chairs the election subcommittee underneath the state government operations committee, which Senator Rest is the chair of. So although Larson is the overall expert here, Senator Rest has the oversight there. So. I think we'll do the best we can to try to work through the differences and work through counsel on this list too. Let me, I don't know, as I say, since no motions were made, I don't know where we're going on this. I'll give you just my sense. This is, you know, not a position that my side has come up with. I just don't see any way in the world we can do sick leave benefits. I think the fiscal note doesn't justify it. I think, you know, $3 million... on the fiscal note, you can't stretch it to get there. I don't see us doing it. If the budget trend study is something the Senate would like to do, listen to Representative Solberg. If that is not where the House wishes to go, obviously, you know, we can't get it done if the House doesn't wish to do that. MAPS, we've agreed to do something. It's just I think we've got to figure out where the number is going to be. I'll give you a proposal. Well, we try to talk about domestic partners. There's no resolution. I don't know where we're going to go on that. We did not move the Senate position, but if there's a desire to consider the Senate position, I that motion can be made. It was not made. The bonding language we talked about, I think I sense some discomfort there. Unless there's a resolution on that one, I don't know that can be done. And the clock is running out. So these things are going to have to be done rather quickly. That leaves a couple of issues here. There's about $10 million. The Senate has discussed using it for capital renovation. The House, you know, has proposed money, funds, for the Department of Revenue's tax system. As I say, you can't do part of one and part of the other. It's all or nothing, I think. I think what the Senate is interested in doing is this. Although we metered out the election bills, we passed them separately. We did not put them in the omnibus bill. It was not our intention to have them in this omnibus bill. In fact, Senator Rust has been quite adamant that they would not be in an omnibus bill or in this bill. But we are open to the idea of suggestion that if you're willing to look at, as a package, putting the doing election bills here, and we'll have to decide which is better language, Senate or House, but we've got most of the bases covered here. Plus capital renovation, we're interested in that. If the House is not interested in that, I really don't have a counter offer for that, except I don't see that we're going to do the election bills here. I just don't see it. I don't think we're going to have the votes for that. As to what's left in Article 2, my personal view is there's absolutely nothing left in Article 2 that I choose to spend any more time on. Now, if there's some issues, I went through a list last night. Is there some things we can reach quick agreement on? I'm willing to do that. I'm not willing to spend any more time on Article 2 unless we have a quick agreement. I am absolutely not interested in taking anything in Article 2 and trying to package that against the budget issues, the other big ticket items. I'm not interested in that. As far as I'm concerned, we're done on Article 2, unless we reach agreement on whatever issues are there. That's where I'm at. I'm not speaking for my confreres. That's my position.
But let me throw... I'll be happy to adjourn or to recess.
Recess right now. Give you time to meet with the House members before you have to leave, and then I anticipate you'll be back. What time do you anticipate?
9:30.
So 9:30. Okay. We'll recess until 9:30, and then hopefully we can make some progress and get done this evening. So, is there anything else that anybody wants to bring to our attention before we recess? If not, the conference committee is in recess until 9:30. We will call back to order the conference committee on Senate File 1997. And Representative Kahn, thank you and the House members for the offer. I think we're making quite good progress. The big issue in reviewing House offer number 3 is still going to be the capital restoration. We do feel strongly about that, but if we can reach agreement there, I think that we can pretty much get there. Within your offer, we still don't think that on the domestic partner language, we just don't think it's workable for a significant individual. We think that it's just a cleaner, more direct way to go with the Senate language if we're going to have anything on domestic partners in the bill at no cost. On the elections provisions, which we do, again, believe should be tied to capital restoration, just to clarify, we're quite willing to have Senator Rest talk to Representative Hilty and said, if we can get this issue resolved, we'll let you basically take all the House language if you want, take the Senate language you like, because as you heard from Mr. Watson when he was discussing election provisions, there's some technical difference between the two. You know, we're really not so concerned. If we can reach an agreement on the capital restoration, we're more than happy to have you decide which of the same or similar provisions you want in there. We're not going to hold anything up on that. And the Secretary of State housekeeping is fine. Obviously, the things that we already said that we would agree to on Article 2, I said that last night. And some we already had actually adopted separately, but the remaining list here are the things that I said that we would go along with, and we will. The budget offer, the bottom line, as I indicated, we still would like to see the $10 million in capital restoration. Now, we would suggest that what you allocated as $1.5 million be moved down to MAPS risk mitigation, simply because they did indicate that they need about $7 million, $2.5 ongoing, the rest, you know, for anything that's going to go wrong. They thought they were actually looking for the $7 million. This puts them slightly above that, but they indicate they just don't know. It doesn't leave anything left for revenue integrated tax system, but... I think that's been our position before. That still is where we're at. We'd like to wrap up things as quickly as we can. But we do appreciate the fact that you were able to put something together here. So that's our thinking at the moment.
Mr. Chairman, you have no movement off the $10 million for capital restoration. A problem not just in, that's a problem not really in this committee, but in the people that are looking over our shoulders.
Madam Chair, I think I've had some conversations with Ms. Stark that there may be ways to bring it down. I don't know that it helps the revenue integrated system. I think $10 million is still too low for that. As I understand it, I mean, we've been talking about how you can't shave it anymore. I still think they need about $16 million to make it work. I think we could come down with it. I don't know where the money, if we brought capital restoration down, where do you reallocate? It's one-time money, and you know there's limits to what you can do with the one-time money. I think we could come down off the number, but we need some ideas and some help to get there, and we're still willing to try to see what we can do. If you want to say, you can't do a revenue integrated tax system. Representative Solberg.
But Mr. Chair, I've had a couple of conversations this evening with both the commissioners of Hansen and the commissioner of Lord Inis.
Mm-hmm.
And any agency that comes in with a request and would say, yeah, we want the whole bottle of wax is $16 million and that kind of stuff. Sure. And I think as I understand that, serving on the tax committee, and I had another conversation this evening with Manis, is that right? Manson. Kind of a long conversation with him, and they're doing some reallocation within their system for this. They need to go down that line. They need to start accumulating some funds. My understanding is that as the Department of Administration would like $29 million to put down the capital restoration, they would like to have $16 million to go down the revenue integrated system. And quite frankly, it's not in the budget to do any of that. We're willing as I was looking for my papers that Senator Rest had the other day from the Department of Administration, and they were things like analysis, and they testified that they needed to have some consultants in place. We're stretching it, quite frankly, at the $1.5 million. I bought into the fact, I think the House has bought into the fact, and consulting with some of the members of the ad hoc, I think there's five from the Senate and five from the House, on the study commission. But when you look at the first three points of that, it seems to me that the $1.5 million would allow them to bring that group together to talk about the issues that involve not only the Capitol, but this building as well, because this has to be in the mix of things. This is the Capitol, is the House and the Senate, and this is the House building, the tunnel security, all the contentious items that are around that. Come to some consensus of where you go down. Bring in enough money, as they testified, for some of the expertise to be able to have happen there, to bring in the technicians that need to be in consultants. And then, at that particular point next year, come back with a report for us and say, this is the way we want to go. And then for the last part of that, for the schematic drawings, that's a bonding issue. In fact, all of this is a bonding issue, to tell you the truth. But let's do it right the first time and not say we're going to allocate $10 million to go down the schematics that are then going to be run into a big buzzsaw again and be rejected by one body or the other because it wasn't done right. And I've bought into the fact, I think I can convince my colleagues, that you need to have some resources for those technicians that come in and say, you know, you're not going to do the schematic drawings, but you're going to say, these are some of the options you're going to have for HVAC or remodeling this building or what kind of things you need for the security. And I just feel that the first three processes or the first two processes in that memo are the most important things for us to do this evening. This is not a bonding committee. We shouldn't be doing any of it. I mean, it should have been in the bonding bill. But there is some cash for that, and let's go down that particular line and do it right, bring it back for the bonding committee the next year to do the rest of it. You'll have a good, solid support from both the House and the Senate sides if you go down that road. If you continue down the road that you're going, there's going to be nothing. It's going to be 10 years before we resolve these issues between the two lines.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Quigley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Solberg. I guess, you know, as I think about it, though, I mean, we've put in $1.2 million in each of three other years. I mean, if we continue chinking away at it to the tune of $1.5 million a year, it's going to take us 173 years with the current projection. You know, it just seems to me that the time is now to act, and, you know, this $10 million is a far cry from what's needed. I don't disagree that, you know, we can do a significant portion of it in bonding, but on the other hand, I mean, we have to go with the realities of the day that we live in as well. And so, you know, it seems to me that we need to take a look at doing what we can, you know, in the year that we have at hand. You know, I guess, you know, to me, $1.5 million seems like a drop in the bucket when you're looking at a $260 million project. So I don't know. I mean, even at $10 million, it's going to take us 25 years to get there. So I don't know. I mean, how much are we going to be able to bond for? We certainly can't put you know, the entire amount into one bonding bill, and maybe that's more than can be used in one term anyway. But you know, it does seem to me that this is, you know, a relatively small amount when you look at the entire picture. So I guess, you know, there are different ways of perceiving it, I guess, and our perception is different from yours. I understand that. But, you know, I think, you know, you've got a leadership person in the room now, so, you know, if you need to take a break and visit with your leadership folks, well, you know, maybe you ought to do that and see what you can come up with.
Mr. Silver.
Mr. Chair, Representative, or Senator Quigley, we spent $1.2 billion on, I guess I would say, the schematic drawings, and what has it bought us? It's bought us controversy. We've got nothing to go forward with. There's no support from the House. You can go down this road with the drawings that you've got, and you'll never get the House to buy into that particular project right now. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't individual members from the House that aren't interested in it. I'm a strong advocate for doing something with the Capitol. I'll be the first one to be the strongest advocate for the whole amount of money. But we have to have a process built in to be able to get the contentious issues that are involved in it together. Let's spend our money wisely this particular time. Spend that time. I think $1.5 million would more than do that to be able to bring those parties together, analyze the needs, be able to bring in some experts on a consultant basis to see, you know, what are some of the options. And then I think that's a wise spend of the money. And then you're buying into saying, okay, we're going to go down this path, and then the next year, next bonding year, you're not going to do it all in 1 year, but then go from that concept that you have, and it may be a totally different concept than what we spent $1.2 million on, that nobody is, or not everybody has bought into, but into a concept that we can go to the next step and then the next step. So, you know, if you give them $10 million, what's that going to buy you? We're going to waste another $10 million and have the controversy again?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, I guess part of my fear is that the $1.5 million will go the same way, that we won't have, you know, what we need. You know, it does seem to me that we need more than the $1.5 million to move ahead and to actually have something substantive that we can agree upon. You know, I'm not sure that the $1.5 million is going to do it for those. You know, I guess, you know, we're just at a difference of opinion there. But
well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Solberg.
As I looked at the state, the five, six bullets that were, we were going down the schematic designs and development for the $10 million. We got to get to the first part first, and then the second that part is a bonding issue. We've always done that. But if you don't get to the first part, if we give $10 million and they go down a road that is schematic drawing and it's all kinds of controversy involved in it again, So what is that going to cost? Let's step back, take a breather, have a cup of coffee, bring in the consultants, bring in the controversies over this issue, spend some money wisely to do the planning that's necessary. And I think that the first two steps, that $1.5 million is the right thing to do. Other than that, the rest of it should have been in bonding bill to begin with.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem, Senator Kubley, is that they went that far and they got into this roadblock of the House. Now, there are some House members who don't agree that that roadblock should exist, but the problem was you've got to start and have the House involved in it and have what's going to happen to the House's house at the same done at the same time, and probably even the Ford building worked into the whole thing to deal with the complex. But what makes sense to me is taking, and I don't know if the 1.5 gets us to, I don't know if you need it, but if we take the six bullet points that we got on this issue, and instead of going down to the bottom, if we go down to the fourth bullet point, prepare the capital budget request in response to the selected plan schedule and cost of the 208 bonding bill, it seems to me that we've gotten awfully far along the way, and above all, I don't see that we've lost any time. I don't see, when you look at where the two other bullet points aren't completed until mid-session 2008. As far as I can see, we go down through the fourth bullet point. And I don't know if that takes $1.5 million or a little bit more than $1.5 million. We're very much on the way to completing this schedule with being able to put the money into bonding in the next session.
Well,
with agreement instead of controversy.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn and Representative Solberg, I guess, my office is on the third floor of the Capitol, and, you know, it's a nice enough area, but, you know, it clearly appears to me that there's repair work to do on the Capitol building itself that doesn't need any more planning. We can move ahead with that now. You know, I don't think we're going to be able to find agreement tonight or tomorrow or any time for $1.5 million. So I don't know where we're going to go with that. Maybe we just need to, you know, sign off on the thing right now and close it up.
So we'll see.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if Nancy Stark or Paul Mandel could come down and kind of walk us through this a little bit and just see, you know, where, if they don't have some dollar amounts they get to, how $10 million might work on this schedule. Because I know there was discussion about where does the money fit on these proposals, and I guess I'd like to hear if they have those numbers laid out yet.
Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Stark with the CAP board. When we put together the talking points, the six bullets that you talk about for the $10 million, and I began to talk about those the other night, we think it is very critical that the working group sit down and hopefully come to a consensus on what is best for the Capitol building, what they would like to see in the design, in the plan for the Capitol building. We understand that there are concerns for parking. There are concerns with the connections of the tunnel and potentially how do we develop or how do we accommodate swing space. All of this, as Commissioner Badgero testified the other night, needs to be done with professionals. People that have the technical knowledge, they have the expertise to take us through that process and facilitate a consensus on the design. Also, we need to think in terms of getting a construction manager on board, and that is something that we have to build in, and we're suggesting that during the schematic design phase. The CM at risk is a construction manager that can, down the road, as we develop the concept, bring forward a guaranteed maximum price. And we obviously need to take whatever the consensus plan is and put together a capital budget request. Our goal is that that request could be developed by mid-October 2008 to prepare for a bonding request. So realistically, we have developed a solid number to get us through this process and also to bring the CM at risk on board and to prepare the capital budget request and to continue the planning effort during the schematic planning effort during session in 08 so we can begin to do design development and ask for that funding separate from the schematic design. And I can share with you the figure that we feel is very solid to do this work based on the fact that we have an agreed upon concept by the working group. And that figure is $4.7
million. Mr. Chair?
That would allow us to keep to be able to keep our design moving forward during the 08 session.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Silver?
Mr. Stark, does that bring all six of those bullet points to play then?
No. What we have done is we have taken our design through schematic design, but we have not entered into design development or construction documents. That we would enter into after session in 08.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Silver?
Tell me why you have to have a construction manager at risk. But last night they were talking about, when we asked these questions, about trying our best to say we need to have the process in place to help in going working through all the controversies of this, and then some expertise to be able to say, well, you know, some consultants as opposed to a construction manager, some consultants to be able to come in and say, well, you know, if you go down this road and these are some of the issues you may need to face. That's where I want to go. I don't want to be able to go to a schematic drawing where the decision's made. I want to be able to give you some resources so you can bring in an engineer or an HVAC person or a security person and say, you know, if we do this, these are some of the options that this study group can look at. What are some of the options you may have for the parking? How does that relate to security? How does that relate to access of the building? How does it relate to the use of this particular building? And to go down to the construction manager part, as opposed to the opportunity to bring in some consultants to help in that planning process, is where I have a difficult time going to that particular phase.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, the construction manager is a part of the team. The design professionals that you refer to, the architects and engineers, are also part of the team. And one of the things that makes this project so intensive, if you will, is that we want to maintain the Capitol as a working building. We do not have the luxury, as other state capitals have done, to empty out their buildings. So the phasing and the estimating of each of these phases is very integral and very tied to how we bring forward our bonding request. And the CM at risk is a person or a team member that can bring that forward. So they are integral with the rest of the design professionals.
So,
Professor Holbert,
let me try to understand the methodology a little bit. If we went through point three, what would each of these particular bullet points cost?
Ms. Stark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, as we looked at our figures that we established when we based our previous request on the volume of work that we had, 4.7 brings us through that process of preparing a capital budget request with schematic design.
Well, I don't think anybody is ready to go down that road yet. And from this side, you've got so much controversy between the House and the Senate, you've got to solve that problem first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Silberg, Paul Mandel with the CAP Board, Principal Planner with the CAP Board. Part of the first thing we do is to go after the controversies, to look at all the options, to get the technical team on board, to look at all and assess all the costs of implications of each scenario and each alternative. The construction manager at risk helps us avoid problems that other state capitals have had that have not had a construction manager at risk, and it's a minor portion of the whole budget. The schematic is needed to flesh out the numbers solidly enough so that we can speak with certitude on the capital budget's request, so that next year we're not back here looking at numbers that we're not quite sure of. And that's why, I mean, we may not even finish schematic, but the schematic is what informs that capital budget request. We would not go forward with design development at that point.
But Mr. Chair,
Mr. Goldberg,
it's that last part that you have that's a bonding request. That's a typical bonding request, and this is not a bonding committee. This is State Government Finance Committee, and I understand that. And I understand that there's an attempt that wasn't included in the bonding committee, so we're trying to keep it going forward. But the very last, the schematic, that particular phase is a bondable request, is it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Silberg, it would be a bondable request. It would also be, obviously, something that could be covered with one-time money, which was Senator Langseth's idea the whole time for the entire project, including construction at the beginning of the bonding session.
Mr. Chair, Silberg, sir, I'm not against that one-time money. But the people sitting behind me also say they need some money for the integrated tax study or integrated system. That helps bring in tax money in an efficient way. And I don't want to be political on this, until the governor comes up with some additional resources that we have a lot bigger target in here, we're not going to do both. We're going to make some decisions. I want to help you out to the first part, but not to do the bonding part. I want you to be able to solve the problem of the controversy that exists between. Or if you don't solve that problem, it's going to be 10 years from now, and you're going to be fighting this fight long after I'm gone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, our concern is that if we continue to, in effect, nickel and dime this, as Senator Kugley spoke to, we're going to just schematic. We're already going to be losing several months next session. We'll be already a year to 2 years behind schedule. And we're trying to fix this building before disasters start occurring in the building. And I recognize the fact that the tax compliance may bring in some money, but we've already come down from 29 to 15 to 10 and now at 4.7. We feel that this is a bottom number, because we need to keep the project, we need to flesh out the numbers, we need to have certitude when we come back to you folks next year for the bonding bill with numbers that we can feel confident about. And you have to get at least partly into schematic to get to that point of certitude. A concept plan does not give us that certitude.
No, Mr. Chair, I don't want to beat a dead horse, because we're not going to go very far, but you just said you need to get partly into schematic. Now give me the cost of partly.
Well, all right, Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, our concern is that because the project has grown looking at the concerns for the tunnel, looking at concerns for the Ford building, looking at concerns for this building, we're not just talking about the Capitol building. And when we started talking about the $29 million, that was just the Capitol building. We don't know how broad and how wide this consideration and getting to a consensus is going to be. It could be that would eat up so much that we don't have enough money to get into schematic at all. And that's why we feel that 4.7 really is necessary to make sure we get to a point that we can be there. If we don't spend it all, we don't spend it all. But we have to get to a point where we can at least deliver the goods for you next year when you're looking for bigger numbers and you need to go to the bonding bill with a certitude that X number of dollars, because we're already behind schedule dramatically, and as you've been on the tour and you've seen the condition of the mechanical and electrical, I don't think anyone's doubting that that's needed. And every year we delay, we risk things happening to this building.
Sir, Representative Senator Kubley, I understand your office needs help. Look around this building.
Well, it isn't, Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg. It isn't my office. It's out in the area around the dome and, you know, in the public area. That's where the need is in terms of the repair to the Capitol building itself. You know, I don't think anybody's looking to enhance their office. I mean, you know, that kind of work isn't going to be done while most of us are here either. So, you know, and I sincerely hope you have more than 10 years left in you.
Well, I hope I have more 10 years left. I don't necessarily be going to be around this day.
Oh, okay. I read that wrong.
Senator Olstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've been involved in millions of dollars of construction as a school board member and as a county commissioner. And one of the things that, when you're talking about a construction manager at risk, does that mean that you're not going to go this won't be let out on a bid then for a $260 million project, that the construction manager will release, they'll be the manager throughout the whole project, they'll be releasing bids on the steel work, the cement work, so they're actually going to be like the project manager and CM the whole project. So we won't be going with a bid for the capital then. Is that the plan?
The plan is, Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, one of the things that we want to do with the capital, and we have learned from others' experience, is that the construction manager at risk provides the opportunity to have a guaranteed maximum price, a solid price for the work of the concept so developed. And we feel that, as it was discussed a few nights ago, that is where Kansas had some issues, because they did not have a construction manager at risk. The intent is, much like for the selection of the design team, to go forward with a selection of construction managers, to cast an RFP nationwide, is what we also did when we selected the design team. Excuse me. And so it would be I'm not sure the exact word to describe the process, but it would be a very similar process to the way we selected the design team. And we would ask for qualifications and for also material back from an RFP or response to an RFP.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
Ms. Stark, as we were talking and thinking about these six bullet points, my memory was that we had talked about it the other night, and the number that we had to go through the completion of the schematic work was $2.5 million. I remember that was the number stated. I went back and dug through what I thought was my recycling pile, and I pulled out the paper and I drew the line there, and it was $2.5 million. I'm confused as to why that number seems to be different. Maybe that was just an off-the-cuff number or something like that. Or maybe it was $7.5 million to go from there to the end, and I assume that the remainder would be $2.5 million. But
Mr. Chair,
maybe I'm completely off, but I don't think so.
I'm not sure where that number came from.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I think that the $2.4 was what we had last year for the dome and some of the schematic. That's the only reference to the 2.4. We did not attach numbers specifically to this.
No, it was in, you're right, it was not written down, but it was in the presentation on this particular option. But I could be wrong, but that's my memory, and that's what my notes show.
I think, Chair, Representative, I think that was in reference to the letter that was accompanying the memo. where you talk about past 05 and 06 funding. And in 06, it was $2.4 million that addressed both the dome and the schematic design work.
Okay. Good thing.
Got a pile of
Well.
I guess I have to get a sense. Is the House saying $1.5 million and not a cent more? Because what I've heard from the CAP board is that they believe they could proceed with 4.7, but I don't know where you get 4.7 unless you pull money out of MAPS, unless you pull out of integrated tax system. I don't know where it comes from. And if the House's position is it's got to be 1.5, and that's it, then I think the Senate says, you know, maybe we should consider taking off the table with the election provisions and Secretary of State language. You know, let's you know move on. Do you want to try to get one to 4.7, or should we just stop where we're at? I guess that's where I'm at.
Maybe we can have just a 5 minute conference, 10 minute conference.
Sure. Because I'm prepared to say, fine, let's drop capital restoration, but then all the election stuff goes out. All of it. Except the stuff we already adopted. That stays in, obviously. But let's figure out where we're at. Okay, good morning. We're back on the record. And Representative Kahn, I think we found some way to deal with the capital restoration issue. Let's see. Who you want to try to describe it or should I?
I'll start it and then you fill in when I don't have it.
Okay.
We decided to break it up into two parts. A facilitated planning part that would go into this bill and that would get together all of the interested parties, and they're finding. Does anybody here know that we have a joint rule that says you can't form a working group in a conference committee? You can refer to one. But anyway, that's one of the things that they're working out with. They're working out with that. So they're working out some way to give an existence that of a. Then there's a promise to put up to $4 million into the new capital bonding bill, which we all believe that there will be a capital bonding bill, and the and we've discussed this with the CAP board people and so forth, and that's okay with them. And with the final backup, if for some reason there isn't a capital bonding bill and there isn't a new version of this bill, that there'll be we'll find another bill as a vehicle so that that. The preference is to have it be part of the capital bonding bill process, have it be part of the bonding process, have the governor on board, or at least
not
off board, no. Whatever. And and then and then go on from there. And then essentially, I guess the were we putting the rest of the money into that? I don't know. We'll put, and so then the money from the capital restoration, the extra money from the capital restoration will go into the MAPS risk mitigation.
That is my understanding. Again, it does cover the $4.75 million that the CAP board says that they need. As long as the House and the Senate are on board with this, we believe that the governor is not going to oppose it. Again, we have no guarantees right now that he's going to where he's going to be on it, but we believe that this is something that can go forward, and hopefully in a second bonding bill with the $4 million. But if not, there will be some other way to do it. Out of the $1.5 million that the House had proposed for capital restoration, this bill would only need to carry $475,000. The balance...
No.
$45 million.
No.
I'm sorry. What am I saying?
$750,000.
Yeah, okay. $750,000.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yes.
thought it was 100.
No. And what's
that was the first suggestion. Moved it up from that.
Yeah. And the balance, the rest would be dropping down to maps. So maps would end up being 6,319,000. Okay. Now, I think that covers almost everything, but I think, Representative Kahn, you had indicated a different approach to the domestic partner language.
Yes, this was, one of the things is a sense of just starting to talk about this subject in state law, and one of the suggestions actually came from Representative Erdahl. We actually want to write this into state law as the Erdahl Emmer provision. And it's kind of like a Tennyson warning. No, this is actually serious. The language would be to do a study of the, and that's much better than a fiscal note coming out of someone's head. It would be a study. We do the definition of significant individual that we have in the House bill, and then we do a study on the cost of the significant, of the cost of giving the benefits to significant individuals, and then we'd have that study come in before the next legislative session. So we'd have some language that kind of shows we're intending to do something in this direction. It's something, obviously, with the definitions, it's something that could be open. The last, from the Commissioner of Employee Relations, we've gotten this issue that it should be, it's properly a topic of negotiation. We think by putting the definitions into state law, that kind of puts it visible as a topic of negotiation. And I think we're violating nothing in any of the visions that we've had, so we'd like to do that.
Sure. And Representative Kahn, in talking to the Senate conferees, they did express a desire. They wish that we could go gone ahead with the language on domestic partners. However, they recognize that we're going to have to get moving, wrap this up, and they were willing to go along with the proposal on the study.
Okay.
They're not too happy about it, but they're willing to do it. So.
He's having a heart attack.
Yep.
The very question is, do we write that it's the Erdahl Emmer proposal?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I mean, you don't want to change that so that it says the Erdahl Epitaph Bill. No.
Hey, we're running him for governor on this.
Yeah. Representative Rodo, I believe, giving credit where it's due. So,
actually, he's got a good suggestion.
Yes, he does.
Yes,
thank you.
I
think that with those changes, then House Offer 3, we will be prepared to accept that with those changes to turn the domestic partner language into the study of the cost and the benefits. Then to change capital restoration to $750,000 and drop the remaining balance down to MAPS risk mitigation, with the proviso that $4 million will be available in either the next bonding bill or some follow-on bonding bill, or some other bill, some vehicle somehow. The $4 million this session is going to be available. To do that, with the understanding that it is not going to be opposed by the governor. If the governor is opposed to it, I don't think it's going to be very difficult to proceed with that. So, I don't know. Do we need to vote on that? Do you think, or
in the interest of time, mm-hmm. and we could go through these things one by one. I think you could accept House Offer 3 as you discussed it with the with the discussion that we've had on the domestic partners. We do need to wait. We could do that. And so then we know that we're off there. We do need to wait. We're waiting for language for that facilitative study.
Right. So
we've agreed in this process, yeah, and then we can agree on this. We're well on our way to closing up the bill.
Is there discussion on House Offer 3 as modified, as we discussed? Is there discussion on that?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Solberg.
Does that include then the elections stuff?
Yes. Yes. Yes, it does.
The Article 5?
Yes.
Articles 4 and 5, and we'll have to figure out a good process, but if the House wants to have basically all the House language in, there's not really substantive differences in there, but in some places the Senate language might be better, but we can work on that. I don't think we're going to finish the bill tonight, but we've got time to identify where we would like to have it done, so. But the election language and Secretary of State language is included, as is part of the offer. Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails.
We have to go with him. He explains this to his caucus.
Madam,
you did a good job.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, yeah, we've got a few other things I'd like to wrap up tonight. Senator Cohen has been waiting. We will not be able to take a vote, I think, on the this bonding language, but he did want to address the conference committee and express his interest and concerns there, and we'll have some more testimony, I believe, tomorrow on that. So as long as he's here, I thought we would have him address the conference committee and discuss what he would like.
Right. And, Mr. Chairman, let me add something to this, too. As long as we are looking at the philosophy of bonding language, I've asked Gopal Khanna to try and work out some language, hopefully for tomorrow, so we can start looking at the idea of doing bonding. Using bonding to do technology language. I don't care how many people have told me that it's not constitutional. I just know that the Constitution didn't say we couldn't bond for technology.
And you've read it.
Yeah, I just know. I just know it didn't say that.
There you go. Senator Cohen, welcome to the conference committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I begin, I know it's late. Would you prefer, if you're going to have a further discussion on this tomorrow, would you prefer to do it all at once?
No.
As long as you're here, if you want to just express your thoughts, you're welcome to return tomorrow. But we have the A33 amendment. We are not going to take any action on it tonight. But if you want to express, you have been waiting, if you want to express some of your concerns on the topic, please feel. But
okay, Mr. Chairman, members, I appreciate the chance to talk for a couple minutes with you relative to this issue. Let me indicate, as you heard earlier today from Mr. Watson, the language being discussed is basically House language. I believe Mr. Watson, wherever you are, you indicated that earlier today it was House File 886, which was placed into the capital investment bill by the House. I don't know if that was done in committee or on the floor, but was passed off the floor of the House, went into the conference committee. In the conference committee, we discussed the issue briefly. Senator Langseth and I have worked on this as well, and the authors of the original legislative proposal were Senator Langseth and Representative Hausman, and so both agreed quite readily to put it into the conference committee report. As members know, there were allegations that the language continued an unconstitutional type of system relative to some of these bonding efforts, and with the fear that the governor would veto the bill, possibly, or use that as an excuse, because he obviously wanted to veto the bill, as we well know, it was removed from the conference committee report. It was not on the floor of the House and the Senate in that report. Let me offer you a couple perspectives. As somebody who's been involved with these issues going back to 1996, with the appropriation for the Science Museum in St. Paul, this legislature has made a decision over the last number of years that it is an appropriate use of bonding proceeds and appropriations for support for what are called, quote, local projects. I think it's the position, I won't speak looking around the table. We have a couple of new members, Senator Olsen, Representative Winkler, who have not been present in these discussions before. But certainly there have been a host of issues supported by, I would guess, I won't say all members of the legislature, but most members of the legislature over the last number of years, who have felt that it is appropriate for the legislature to be a partner in building the kinds of structures that add to the quality of life in the state of Minnesota, even if those efforts are not directly part of a state government. Obviously, the notable examples, I mentioned the Science Museum, certainly the one that had the most visibility was probably the Guthrie Theater effort. There have been other arts proposals, as we know. What's happened, Mr. Chairman and members, is that the Department of Finance has taken the position at some point that these kinds of efforts did not meet constitutional muster. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'll be very clear, and you'll have the opportunity, I guess, tomorrow to hear people who have more expertise in the constitutional aspects of this than myself. But the history of this has been that several years ago, with the appropriation in 2003 of the Guthrie Theater and the Children's Theater, the Department of Finance started to take a stronger position as to why this could not happen. I'm not sure, and I've asked some of the attorneys at Fagre & Benson, which has been the lead counsel in terms of dealing with this from my perspective, to see where else this has happened in terms of these other nonprofit kinds of appropriations. I do know something about the history of the Guthrie and the Children's Theater. Mr. Sousen, the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Finance, placed a call after the state legislature met and adjourned in 2003. He placed a call to Joe Dowling, the Artistic Director of the Guthrie Theater, and I know this from Mr. Dowling directly, and indicated to him that the legislature might have suggested this money, but that there were other types of hurdles the Guthrie had to go through, including the requirement that the city of Minneapolis had to have approval on a year-to-year basis of the play selections by the Guthrie Theater. Mr. Dowling obviously was not pleased, having gone through, as we know, the fights here at the state legislature, contacted his legislative counsel, who contacted myself. I suggested, the Children's Theater was going through the same thing. I suggested, and I make clear, Mr. Chairman and members, this is not a partisan issue. Governor Plenty has spoken with pride at both the Guthrie groundbreaking and the Children's Theater dedication, final dedication. And he's talked many other places about how these kinds of efforts have added to the quality of life in Minnesota. What happened in 2003 with the Guthrie and Children's is that a member or members of the governor's staff went to the Department of Finance and said these were important appropriations to the governor, and the Department of Finance should not be involved in what was attempted to be done by Mr. Sousen. Fast forward to the past year when other appropriations were passed by the legislature, notably the McPhail provision, the Schubert Theater, and the Ordway Theater in St. Paul. Some of the same concerns were raised. At that time, a working group began to be involved, headed by lawyers at Fagre, and members heard earlier today from Ms. Rahm, who was probably the lead counsel at Fagre in these efforts. And the effort was to come up with language that might satisfy these types of concerns in a way that would be constitutional. What happened in these last several months is the Department of Finance, with previous Commissioner Ingeson and Mr. Sousen, came up with their language. That was introduced in legislation by, as I mentioned, Sarah Langseth and Representative Hausman. However, the language put place in the bonding bill was significantly different this year than what apparently Mr. Sousen wanted. And what's happened is every time in these last several weeks when there's been an effort to try to deal with the issue, the marker keeps on getting pushed further and further and further and further back. And what's happened in the last several days is when the language was taken out, and I might add, there was no, when the language was being circulated and being discussed for the bonding bill, the language placed in the bonding bill by both sides a couple of weeks ago, there was never any concern expressed by the Department of Finance, at least to a legislative committee that I'm aware of, or to legislators individually. Nothing. Then, when it looks like the bonding bill is coming to finality, at the request, I believe, of the Department of Finance, the Dorsey & Whitney law firm, which has served as bond counsel, raises concerns about the constitutionality of the language in the bonding bill. Again, that language was removed. However, that day or the next day, Senator Langseth and Representative Hausman sent a letter to the Dorsey law firm asking for explicit direction on what was unconstitutional about the proposed language placed in the bonding bill and what ought to be done to correct it. A letter, and I don't have it with me, but I can bring it tomorrow. A letter came back from the Dorsey law firm indicating that there were two particular sections that were offensive. The working group went back to work to deal with the issue and attempt to come up with language that would be appropriate. That language is what is contained within, Mr. Chairman, whatever amendment you have with you. I forget what the number is.
It's A33.
That encompasses the further work of this working group. Now, what happened yesterday is there were conversations between the Dorsey Law Firm and the Fabry Law Firm. And an attorney at the Dorsey Firm made it clear, and I hope I'm not misstating this, and Ms. Rahm can correct me if I'm misstating this, an attorney at the Dorsey Law Firm indicated that the language seemed to pass constitutional muster. Additionally, Mr. Watson testified to the conference committee earlier today that in his conversations with the representative of the Department of Finance yesterday, that she seemed to feel that with the exception of one particular phrase, several words, the proposed amendment passed constitutional muster. However, what the attorney from Dorsey told Ms. Rahm is that she had been instructed by the client, Mr. Sousen, to no longer opine as to whether or not that language was constitutional, and in effect was told not to deal with anybody else relative to this. Now, I'll suggest, Mr. Chairman and members, that Dorsey and Whitney might be bond counsel to the state, but in that context, we're as much the client as the Department of Finance. And what we have here is a situation where the Department of Finance takes a position as a matter of public policy that this is not the way to go. That's a legitimate position of public policy. I and many, many other legislators disagree. And yet we keep on having, as I said, the marker pushed further and further and further and further back. We have worked on language. I've not worked on the language. I'm not a bond counsel. But those who have expertise have worked on this language and have come up with language that seemed to pass muster until we heard earlier today from the representative of the Department of Finance, Mr. Sousen still has lots of concerns, even though that's directly contrary to what the attorney from Dorsey and Whitney said yesterday or what the other person from the Department of Finance told Mr. Watson yesterday. And that's why, Mr. Chairman and members, if this committee and other members of the legislature, whether it be Senator Langseth or Representative Hausman's committees, expect to continue to present these kinds of proposals to citizens of Minnesota, proposals supported by numerous legislators over the last number of years, and expect our efforts to promote a greater quality of life in Minnesota to continue, some committee, somebody in this legislature, in this session, is going to have to take the step, once and for all, to try to present a fix which passes muster with seemingly almost everyone, with one exception. So, Mr. Chairman, I presented the history and the chronology of this. I don't speak to this committee as bond counsel or anyone who has that kind of expertise. But I hope tomorrow, Mr. Chairman, when you and Representative Conn, when you're chairing this conference committee, that when you have a fuller exposition of this, that you'll have the opportunity to listen to possibly Mr. Sousen and to have with him side by side Ms. Rahm or others who have that degree of expertise. Possibly by tomorrow morning, there'd be the opportunity to listen to Representative Hausman and Sarah Langseth. I'm not here speaking for them, certainly. I do know that they are the authors of the proposed fix. There are people who feel strongly about this. It's not my position to put words in their mouth. I've dealt at greater length with Sarah Langseth about this than with Representative Hausman. But possibly you could have a fuller exposition, because there is a chance that this might be the only place where we can deal with this issue. And I will absolutely assure you, from the work I've done on these issues over the last several years, that come next year, with a bonding bill, when members of this committee and other members of the legislature expect and hope that we will provide these kinds of efforts, making a great deal of difference to people throughout the state of Minnesota, that we will have these problems time and time again. So, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the chance to present that chronology, and I hope tomorrow there will be the opportunity to have this fuller exposition so members of this committee can make a decision as to whether or not this language is appropriate for inclusion in this particular conference committee report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We look forward to getting more information today.
There's been passed out to members a proposed language, I think, for the facilitated process. Representative Kahn and I just looked at over, and it, the last line says that it must be completed by September 30th, 2007. We think that should be pushed back. I don't see any magic in having it done by September 30th. I mean, we'd certainly want it done by the start of the next legislative session, but we were thinking by the end of the calendar year would probably be more appropriate. If council and others have a chance to look over other members. Oh, you haven't seen it? Oh, it has not been distributed. I'm sorry. Could you distribute that? Yes. This is just some proposed language on a facilitated process, so it's being distributed right now.
With the date change, as you get it, we've decided September seemed awfully tight, so we made it December.
December 31st, you think?
31st.
Mr. Chairman, maybe even it might even give more flexibility by, I was going to say, by the start of the next legislative session or something like that.
No, I think that's a little too late.
Okay.
I really think. But maybe January 15th is a little bit messy. We're looking at the way people do, maybe January. There, we've kind of done this thing about legislative reports usually being January.
I was the instigator of that one, yes.
Terrific.
Yeah, I started noticing those reports were due on January 1st, and I think if we change the date at the end of January 15, 2008, that gives people time to get through the holidays and whatever they have to do. Could people kind of look over the language and let us know whether or not there's anything in here?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Solberg.
Inform that part of the negotiations to have this in process for the bonding bill for next year. So maybe the September 30th is the right date.
Because it's hard to remember all the conversations, as Mr. Chairman, as they're occurring. But I guess what happens is that there are two deadlines with the bonding bills, putting the bonding bills together. Although, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, as I look at this, it is the facilitated planning process. And so I think, that's going to be a heavy process, but if you do need it in time for the bonding bill, then maybe the September 30th is the right date.
Okay, let's keep at that one. We're still going to have a meeting tomorrow, and if we find out that this is wrong, I think we can...
Sure.
Okay. Is there a discussion? Have our professional staff had a chance to go over this? Any issues? If not, Representative Kahn moves the language be incorporated... I guess as rider language, is that what it'd be within the conference committee report? Is there further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. We do have, I think, a few quick things we need to address before we wrap up for the evening. Our fiscal analysts have advised us that there is, on the LCC appropriation, there's a bit of a tails issue, and Mr. Lundeen and Ms. Roberts, could you describe what it is, and do you have any suggestions what we should do here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we've been informed by leadership that the $750,000 that was given to LCC, we've been carrying it as one time, should actually be an ongoing appropriation that goes into the base. And right now, with the spreadsheet as we've adopted it, we've got about $274,000 on the bottom line. So in order to accommodate that, we would have to move some dollars around in the tail.
Madam Chair, obviously we're going to have to borrow some money. You know, within our budget division, whenever we looked at IT security sometimes, you know, because they had a large amount, and we didn't always know what was needed there, but we usually try to borrow some there if we needed some. If you have to move something from somewhere to somewhere, that seems as logical as any to me to make the LCC numbers
work? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? IT or IT security?
And we need 500, is that? Or 480?
476 is needed to do that.
Is that per year? Or just total?
No, just total.
And so does that mean half of that per year?
You know, what you could do, if it's just the, if it's just the tails problem, not a total problem, why don't you give the IT, and IT security seems to me as if a lot of that's going to be things that you'd start, you could front load some of that. So why don't you put the money onto, why don't you give more money to IT security in the first year and take the money from the tails? Will that work?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
So.
Okay. Let's just vote on that idea. We don't have the actual numbers, but staff will be directed to take money from load up, add some more money in the front load, and then take it out of the tails and to help the LCC. Discussion on that. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Madam Chair, I think we've gone as far as we can go.
Okay. I'd like to bring out at least discuss tonight.
Sure.
So we have it. So there's no surprise. In the repeater part of the, and I don't know if we adopted that or not.
Yeah, we did.
Did we adopt all the repeaters the other night?
Well, we just adopted it. Yeah.
Well, I know that one of the repeaters was adopted is, and we talked, I think Representative Rest was kind of agreeing with this, but I don't know if we adopted the language or not. And in there is a repeater, I think, of the place of government that we have to pass each year. And the fiscal staff has said that the place of government calculation is a good calculation, but it seems kind of ridiculous for us to go through the process of adopting it on the House and the Senate.
Okay.
So this would do that with one correction on 1.8 that has to be not faxes, but taxes.
Taxes, not faxes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Relying on yourself.
Yeah.
Sure. We can adopt the language if you wish, Representative Solberg.
We
had agreed to it, but we didn't have the language before us. So Representative Solberg moves the language of it. It's KNA01.
And they got to fill in the different sections.
Yes, and this is part of the House offer that was accepted, which is a partial repealer of the price of government, as appears on the language appears on RD. This is the updated language. Discussion on this motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye, those opposed, the motion prevails. Is there anything further that needs to be done tonight, this morning?
Again,
Mr. Chair.
This is something that we absolutely never discussed. But it's identical language in both bills. And I think because we were going over...
What is it?
It's on R33.
Which article?
52.
Article 2.
Article 2, R33. 52.15 in the House, and 23.15 in the Senate. It's identical language in both bills, and we never discussed it. We skipped over it.
Okay. I think we...
You think we
adopted the Senate? Well...
Oh, okay.
No, we should adopt.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, the... Section 65 on the House side has some additional language that's unrelated to this. So what you want to do, if you're interested in taking this provision, would be to take the Senate section 12.
Because that's the only thing.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Representative Kahn moves. What? And from where to where are we looking at? What?
Mr. Chairman, all you need to do is just refer to Section 12 shown on R32 and R33 on the Senate side.
Okay. Representative Kahn moves adoption of Section 12 on Article 2, which is page R33, the Senate language. Further discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Anything further that needs to be done tonight? We are going to be on a tight deadline to finish tomorrow. It's my understanding the House is going in at 10. The Senate is at 1:30. Representative Kahn.
From what I understand of the deadlines, my suggestion is that this committee reconvene at 8.
Okay.
Okay. And I think House members don't have to be on the floor if we're needed.
We do have a finance meeting tomorrow.
When?
Well, I think I'm the other one. 8:30. No.
Okay.
You are too.
I am too. Oh, but the point is, we're right. We're real. It's not.
Oh, we can't.
Oh.
That's 10.
And that's at
8:30?
At 8:30. South room 200.
What? No, it isn't. 200. It's room 10. It's in room.
It's
in room 10.
That's changed.
Well,
we're available.
Anyway. We're available. I think, given what I've been told of the deadline, that the people would really like this bill closed at 11.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I don't think I think we have to reconvene at 8 here.
Is that sufficient time for our staff to be able to do whatever needs to be done? I don't
when
know.
When they say closed, they mean that we've
agreed on things, but they don't. Yes. They don't. The staff doesn't need the staff to do anything further tonight. That I don't know. I want to make sure.
Yes, I would.
Okay.
Just, you know what happens if it's not going to do with this?
Yeah, are they going to fire us? Yeah, what are they going to do?
No, I think the staff. I think closed means that we've done.
We've agreed
we've
on everything.
We've done everything. We've agreed on everything. We've agreed that we sign it, and then the staff will put it together.
Gotcha. Is there anything anybody wants to bring forward tonight, General Scene?
Well, tomorrow's National Prayer Day, and I'm at two events. Sorry, I was going to be at two events, but I mean, what would it take to really wrap this up tonight? I mean, it seems like Senator Cohen's stuff probably can't be, but I don't imagine they'll be ready for 8 o'clock tomorrow morning either.
Yeah, we will.
We will.
If they want it.
What's the timing of the National Prayer Day thing?
One's at 6:45 and...
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I can pray here.
Your second one is here.
Okay.
You can get to the 6:45 one.
Anything further?
If it's something we really need you for, we'll wait.
Okay. And I don't know if Senator Russ is going to know about that, but you know, the rest of us who are here will. Okay, if nothing further to come before us, we'll be adjourned until 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.